You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
Something happening here.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
Given the importance that's attributed to the CIA as being so important that it has to remain secret, and so important that if you talk about it, you can go to jail. Everything it's done is so important, and yet nobody knows anything about these things. And there, and that is the result of 70 years of fake news. Americans have no understanding of what their government truly is because they don't know what the CIA has done. They don't know about how evil the people who serve in Congress and the bureaucracies truly are. Because all these evil, illegal things are done by the CIA. The CIA has absolute immunity.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Douglas Valentine. Today's show, The Deep State as Fake News. Douglas Valentine is the author of several works of historical nonfiction, including The Phoenix Program, America's Use of Terror in Vietnam, about the CIA in Vietnam, and The Strength of the Wolf and the Strength of the Pack, which discuss the history of federal drug law enforcement. He also edited a poetry anthology, With Our Eyes Wide Open, Poems of the New American Century. Today we discuss his latest book, The CIA as Organized Crime, How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World. Doug Valentine, good to talk to you again.
Thank you for having me on your show.
William Colby gave you unprecedented access to interview CIA officers in order to write your book on the Phoenix program in Vietnam. Your new book is The CIA as Organized Crime, How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World. Why did you title your book The CIA as Organized Crime?
Because everything that the CIA does basically is illegal. And I think of them as the organized crime branch of the United States government. And it's interesting because there's a sort of moral tinge to the title, you know, as if doing something illegal is universally agreed upon as, you know, like a bad thing to do. And I should add that where you enter into a murky moral realm, and I'm not one to defend the CIA, but everybody does illegal things. You know, I mean, I smoked pot for 45 years before it became legal here in the state of Massachusetts. And, you know, all that time, somebody could have, you know, written my biography and called it Doug Valentine as the criminal. You know, I mean, and people do all sorts of illegal things. But it's the extent that of the CIA's illegal actions and it's their impact that make the CIA really a good target of anybody's moral outrage. At the same time, all these things, the CIA does these things illegally because it feels that the American public wants these things done. It just doesn't want to hear about them. Just like Congress authorizes everything that the CIA does. Nothing that the CIA is not a rogue enterprise that is engaging in all these kind of illegal activities, which I chronicle and categorize in excruciating detail in the book. Everything from drug trafficking and arms trafficking to overthrowing foreign governments, to spying on people, to burglaries, to extortion, blackmail, any kind of crime at all they engage in on a massive industrial scale. But Congress doesn't want to hear about it. And in fact, Congress has very gratefully passed lots of laws that make it illegal for anybody to blow the whistle on the CIA's crimes. And the media, through its arrangements with the CIA, does everything it can to cover up the crimes and not tell you about them, on the assumption that the public is too sensitive to know about these things, or that it's in government engages in these kind of industrial scale illegal activities, which are said to never affect America, that these illegal things that they engage in are too horrible for you to know about, and if you knew about them, it would upset you. So you're not told about them, and you're told that none of this affects you personally, that all these illegal things that are being done overseas, for example, and they're being done for your benefit. Well, that's a really big lie, and it's hard to disprove it. If you can't actually document all these illegal things that the CIA is engaged in, because there's laws against talking about them. There's laws against naming CIA officers. If you name a CIA officer, you can go to jail. If you talk about CIA sources and methods, you can go to jail. So, before the laws were passed in 1982, making it illegal to name CIA officers, there was still an agreement between the media and the CIA that they wouldn't talk about it, so that these illegal operations could continue and go on all the time. But we've entered a new phase, which is sort of symbolized by the election of Donald Trump and now the discussion of what's called fake news, which is sort of characterized as a new development, as if there hadn't always been fake news. But what I've been telling you for the last 10 minutes here is that Americans have been subject to fake news throughout steadily and relentlessly, without any interruption, since the CIA was created. Very infrequently do we learn anything about the CIA, and then we only learn about it ex post facto, when something happens that has to be discussed, and then only in the most vague and general ways, without, again, ever naming any particular CIA officer or explaining anything about their sources and methods. So in this sense, given the importance that's attributed to the CIA as being so important that it has to remain secret, and so important that if you talk about it, you can go to jail. Everything it's done is so important, and yet nobody knows anything about these things. And that is the result of 70 years of fake news. And now we're told some, you know, fake news of the media covering up everything that the CIA has done. Americans have no understanding of what their government truly is, because they don't know what the CIA has done. They don't know about how evil the people who serve in Congress and the bureaucracies truly are, because all these evil, illegal things are done by the CIA, and the CIA has absolute immunity. But it all comes back to us, and it has finally erupted with the election of Donald Trump and this new controversy about fake news, as somehow Americans are now going to confront their secret past and the fact that they've been lied to for 70 years, and everything that used to be hidden is now going to be exposed, and we're going to stand up and look in the mirror and see ourselves for exactly what they are. Well, I got news for you. That ain't going to happen. It's still going on, and as much as people talk about fake news, that in itself is fake. We still haven't gotten anywhere near to an honest, open discussion about what the CIA does, and if it really was doing things that were for our benefit and helped us, then we would be able to talk about it. And if it was only the kind of illegal things that, like me smoking pot for a couple of decades, that really were not harming anybody, then what would be the problem in talking about it? But the mere fact that it is illegal to talk about it, and it is never talked about it, is proof that it is devastatingly awful. And all that devastatingly awfulness, which has been hidden from us for 70 years, affects us in countless ways, not least of which is robbing us of our history and our identity. everything that the CIA does comes home to haunt us, most especially in the fact that it's secret from us and we don't know what it is.
How did your book, The CIA as Organized Crime, evolve from your study of the Phoenix Program? Or did it?
Well, yeah, it did a lot. And Phoenix is an important thing to understand if you want to understand the CIA, and not only the CIA, but how the security systems of the government function in secret, and how, again, these secret operations affect you in ways that you don't understand, and how these secret operations affect, actually define most people's basic assumptions about what America is and what it represents and what it symbolizes, and they affect people's self-concepts as individuals. After 70 years of living in a world of illusion and raising children to believe these illusions, you know, it's actually integral to our self-concepts and all our basic assumptions. And the Phoenix Program, which I had, you know, this unusual access to, provides a keyhole. It is a system which I was able to document from beginning to end, from its operational realities to its stated objectives, from the very lowest levels to the very highest levels, to show how CIA policy is created, how it's dissembled in front of Congress and the public, and how it really affects people in terms of it being Phoenix being the ultimate system for providing security for the rich political elite in this country, and how Phoenix becomes the model for not only fighting the war on terror, but for the Department of Homeland Security. And as soon as you have a political figure like Donald Trump, who's willing to pull out all the stops, you can actually, through this kind of Phoenix system that's set up, you can coordinate mass deportations, you can coordinate the prevention of an entire religious class from entering the United States. You can harass it indefinitely. And the security forces which are in place in the Department of Homeland Security are happy to do this. This is what they've been indoctrinated and trained to do, and this is what they've been waiting to do. And as soon as the political climate wants to do it, it can be done, because these systems like Phoenix Program, which is a system, and I explain at length in the book what I mean by system. You know, it's something that's organized and managed, and it has rules and regulations, and it's very cleverly thought out by people who are magna cum laude graduates of Yale University. Very intelligent people put these systems in place, and how those systems, once a political figure like Donald Trump comes along, can be manipulated and used and turned against you. Phoenix was created by the CIA in Vietnam to use to suppress the insurgency there, and not only the insurgency there, but any domestic nationalistic opposition to the puppet government there. And now it's the model for the Department of Homeland Security, and it's going to be used against you, and it's being used against you right now. And if you want to understand how these systems are put in place, then you can read the book and find out. And I should say, another term that's being thrown around a lot, along with fake news, is this idea of a deep state, which I have never used and I would not use, because I don't know what people mean by it. But it seems to be this kind of blank slate that anybody can project anything they want onto it. I think what people mean when they talk about a deep state are these systems like Phoenix that have been put in place, which are so complex that unless you study them like you were going to study anthropology for 4 years at Harvard or the petrochemical industry, you can barely grasp. And so people think that it's somehow secret and hidden from them. But if a person has the time and can study them, then you can understand how these systems work, and you can see how they relate to Congress, to the Department of Justice, the legal system. You can see how they relate to the media. You can see how they relate to foreign operations. And suddenly all these things become clear, and all the things that have been hidden from you appear before you And it's not, you realize that all the facts had been there all along if you'd only had time to study it and look into it. And you realize, well, there really is no deep state. There's just a lot of things that are beyond what you know. And that if you had the time to study them, you could figure it out. You know, I mean, just like executives at Fox News know what the news is going to be 2-3 weeks from now. They know it's brewing, you know, and then they're not surprised on it like you are when you think it's news and it's a rabbit pulled out of a hat. But the people who run the government are plotting these things 3 weeks, 3 months, 3 years, 10 years into the future. And the people in the media are just as aware of what the government has planned, you know, as the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee. So there really isn't a deep state. There really isn't fake news. There's just things you don't know. And don't mythify them and don't make them seem like somehow it's the Wizard of Oz behind, you know, pulling magic tricks, you know. It's all there. You can know it all. It's all very human. It's all very understandable. You just got to devote the time to it and don't get into the mindset of thinking of these people as like somehow they're extra special or something. They've just put a lot of systems in place which are used to control you.
I'm speaking with researcher and author Douglas Valentine. Today's show, The Deep State as Fake News. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. In other words, then, would you say that the deep state is the state? And the issue is basically that citizens don't understand what our country is.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you can make it into a magic show if you know, but that just suits the ruling elite, you know, as if somehow this is all, you know, beyond you, or you can't understand it, or you can't see it. I mean, but that's just not true. I mean, I was a working class kid who, you know, dropped out of college and smoked a lot of pot for a couple of years and liked to drink and was kind of adventurous. And William Colby liked me and he introduced me to a lot of CIA officers and they told me what was going on. And it demythified the whole thing for me. And I'm not saying, well, if I did it, anybody could do it. My situation was unusual. But I can't, having been there and come back, I can tell you there is no mystery to it. The only thing is that the media and your government prevent you from knowing about it. And if you want to know about it, you can. You just got to make them tell you what's going on. And you can do that. You can change laws. But obviously, you got to want to do it bad enough.
Is the CIA being restructured? And if that's the case, what model is the intelligence agency using to reorganize itself?
Well, that's a good question because it was reorganized in 2015 under Brennan, John Brennan, who was the director of Central Intelligence and was a career CIA officer. And again, and to a large extent, it was modeled on this reorganization was modeled on the Phoenix program. The Phoenix program was it's complex, but one of the foundation stones for it were there was a Phoenix directorate. When they created the Phoenix program in Saigon in 1967, in the summer of 1967, they set up a Phoenix directorate in Saigon, which was really like the command center. There was also a Phoenix committee above this directorate, and that Phoenix committee consisted of the CIA station chief and a deputy ambassador who ran civil operations and revolutionary development, and a couple of generals, general who ran counterintelligence, general who ran intelligence. And those five guys were like a executive committee that oversaw this directorate. And the directorate had sub-offices in every region, province, and district in South Vietnam. They set them up over about a year. The provinces were like states in the United States, and the districts were like counties. 44 provinces, every one of them had a Phoenix intelligence operations and coordinating center. And in all the districts, there was a district intelligence operations and coordinating center. And down at the district, they ran informant nets and agent nets into the villages and hamlets, and they tried to identify anybody who was against the government, anybody who was aiding the communists, anybody that could be easily blackmailed, the people in the DIOCs, they all had different prejudices and business interests, and the whole thing was just so corrupt that they used it as a way of just terrifying the population of South Vietnam into supporting the government. And they would send the reports from the district to the province, and the province would send them to the regions, and the regions would send it to the Phoenix Directorate, where it was all incorporated into computer systems, where everybody in South Vietnam had a profile and were rated on a scale of 1 to 5, whether they were actually a dangerous person or somebody who, at the other end of 5 wasn't too dangerous and should just be extorted and blackmailed and ripped off and terrorized. And, but if you were number 1, then you got killed and put in jail for the rest of your life and tortured. And that was the Phoenix system. Well, before I get to how the CIA was restructured, that's the system that's the Department of Homeland Security. The Department of Homeland Security has a group of senior people in the White House and in the CIA and in the FBI and Congress, and they oversee a Department of Homeland Security, which has an office in Washington. It's like the Phoenix Directorate, and it has a fusion center in every state, and every state brings together, just like these Phoenix intelligence operations and coordinating centers did in Vietnam, brings every law enforcement, military, and intelligence agency, plus all sorts of civilian industrial organizations together, and coordinates all their intelligence, all their spy net, all their informant networks, and targets them against Muslims and Mexicans and people, environmentalists, and anybody who's on the blacklist. And it's the exact same thing. And they've just been waiting to spring into action. And of course, first they're going to get rid of all the undocumented Mexicans, and they're going to get rid of all the Muslims that they can. And then when they're done, they're not going to say, oh, gee, well, our job is done. Let's go home. They're going to keep going and going and going and going until they have created, under Trump, a population that's so terrified of the government, will do everything that Trump wants them to do. And the CIA in 2015 reorganized itself the same way under John Brennan. It found that this Phoenix coordinating system, which it had been using as the model for the war on terror and which became the model for Homeland Security, was absolutely the way that it should reorganize itself. And it created around the world a bunch of what are sort of called counterterror centers. And these counterterror centers, I think there's initially set up 15 of them. They're just called centers, but they themselves are modeled on the counterterror center at CIA headquarters. And they function the same way. And they take all these centers, which were activated at the same time as the CIA's latest division. For the first 70 years, it had 4 divisions: intelligence operations, science and technology, and administration. And in 2015, it added a digital innovations division, which is its computer center, which, hacks and keystrokes foreign governments to death without anybody ever noticing it, and spies on foreign corporations, and does everything to Russia and China that the press and Congress are screaming that, Russia and China do to us. Well, I got news for you again. CIA showed everybody the way on how to do that, and now they organize their own division. And so each of those 5 divisions is represented in each of one of these centers, which are in effect like mini CIAs set up all around the world. And they bring together all of the CIA's resources and divisions and branches together in one place. And so they've set up like these coordinating centers around the world. And apparently, there is some rumors that there was so much objection to these centers being set up by career CIA officers who are now found themselves outside of these centers. I mean, the centers can only incorporate so many personnel, that the establishment within the CIA was actually objecting to them. And a lot of people now are in the CIA are hoping that the CIA will disband these centers, which focus power in fewer hands, just like capitalism itself. And in that sense, they're a weapon for political people to use. You know, a political person like a Trump in a White House can now reach into these centers in a way that they could never get through the regular CIA bureaucracy before. And instantaneously look at all the intelligence in, say, China or Russia, and instantaneously launch an operation to do something, whether it's a computer operation or a paramilitary operation or intelligence operation. And you saw Trump try to do it in Yemen, you know, within a few days of being elected. And of course, that was a disaster. But anyway, there's a lot of opposition to this new organization and the CIA, a lot of old career people who feel like they're just going to be left on the outside and not have any say anymore.
Well, if this reorganization of the CIA took place in 2015, then obviously it took place under the Obama administration. So it seems to me that this is a sort of a seamless operation, be it Trump, Obama, whoever is in there, right?
Well, you know, in a sense it is. In a sense of this is the arc, the way things have been developing. But at the same time, you know, when you try to change a massive bureaucracy, there's always resistance from within for the reasons that I was talking about. Like the CIA has had systems in place for 70 years. And in the name of streamlining and highly bureaucratizing and being more efficient, these centers were put in place. But again, it threatened the power of a lot of people who were in the bureaucracy itself. So in one sense, it's seamless, but in the other sense, it's really revolutionary. And of course, the power of computer geeks, you know, I mean, it's like everybody's in shock because all the kids who were, you know, unpopular in high school and retreated into the science lab became computer geeks. Well, now all of a sudden they're in charge, you know, and it's like all the paramilitary guys and the spy guys who used to be like these, you know, the James Bond types are being put out to pasture by these young 25-year-old kids like Ed Snowden, who know how to, you know, take down a government just simply by using a computer to completely disable its power grid, for example. You know, in the old days, the CIA used to have to sneak a paramilitary team into southern China in order to try to blow up a power station. Now you can have a computer geek like Ed Snowden just, you know, hack into their power grid, and you can take down half the country. So the very nature of the spy business is changing, although obviously the paramilitary people are still very important, as we see by, you know, when you want to overthrow like Syria, you know, you still need intelligence people to work with ISIS, and you still need paramilitary people to give them guns and show them how to use them and stuff like that, you know. So certainly the violent, illegal things that the CIA does, and which it is better at doing than anybody. It has its own secret army that just goes around the world, you know, killing and maiming and burning and subverting. You know, it's still the best in the world at doing that. But at the same time, the times are changing, and the geeks are, you know, growing in power within the CIA. And so, you know, it's hard to talk about it as a human thing. But I suppose the CIA is in much turmoil internally, as America, you know, is today itself through all these changes. It, you know, has these systems in place which are supposed to minimize any kind of changes that affect the rest of the country. The CIA and the military, they're more highly systematized, and so that's supposed to protect them. And it probably does protect them to some extent, but at the same time, they are going through changes and being affected by all the stuff that's going on, all the craziness that's going on.
I'm speaking with researcher and author Douglas Valentine. Today's show, The Deep State as Fake News. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Well, now let me ask you this. Donald Trump was elected president. Who elected the CIA? Now, your own book is called The CIA as Organized Crime. So we're talking about an intelligence agency that operates illegally and is undermining the elected president and his what he at least stated all throughout the time he was running. He said he wanted better relations with Russia. It seems to me that the intelligence agencies are trying to keep this Cold War with Russia going. That's what it looks like to me.
You know, I could see, I know most everybody I know sees it that way. And yet, you know, it's rhetoric. I don't know how else to explain it to you guys. People are saying things. It's rhetoric. You know, I mean, they're stated, you know, Trump says, I have better relations with Russia. Well, how the hell do you know that it's true? I mean, every other word that comes out of this guy's mouth is a lie. He says, well, I'm going to build a wall along, you know, Mexico, and Mexicans are going to pay for it. And, I mean, he says there's one outrageous, crazy thing after another, which are totally unrealistic. And yet everybody chooses to believe that somehow when he says, I want better relations with Russia, that he's telling you the truth. Now, I don't believe anything that comes out of the mouth of a politician. You know, I mean, they'll say anything to get elected. And maybe somewhere in his heart of hearts, Trump really, really does have a fondness for the Russians and really thinks that the world would be a better place if we all just held hands with the Russians and everybody got along. But I don't believe it, and I have no reason to believe, given everything that he says, that somehow this is really what he wants. And then at the same time, I've been following politics that center around the CIA for 30 years, and I happen to know that stated policies, whatever the politicians state, even if they really state it as, absolutely, this is what I'm stating that I want to do, that they have unstated policies all the time that diametrically oppose whatever they're stating as fact. And then that's why the CIA exists, is to further the unstated, illegal operations of the United States. And so as the guy right now, as Trump runs the CIA, he's the president. He got elected. Nobody elected the CIA, but when you elect a president, you're saying we trust you to run the CIA because we couldn't possibly have elections to elect every bureaucrat in the government every 2 or 4 or 6 years. Somebody has to be a president who you can trust to run the CIA. And people elected Trump because they think he's smart enough and he's trustworthy enough to run the CIA. You know, and now he runs it. It's his organization. He can appoint all the senior executives, and he can send his instructions to the new CIA director and say, do this, do that. It's his organization to run. And even if there is resistance, he'll stomp it out, you know, in 3 months or 4 months. And there may be some CIA guys that are bitter, just like there were a lot of CIA guys who were very bitter when Obama got elected. You know, the CIA didn't love Obama. He wasn't some candidate that the CIA had run to become president. They had to adjust for Obama, too. And supposedly, there's always this period of adjustment where a politician who gets elected brings in his people, appoints them to cabinet positions, and reorganizes the government ideologically the way he wants it. And that is what I think we're seeing now, is what happens when any president gets elected and he's replacing Obama and his people have been there for 8 years. And that's all that's happening. There is no overture to make the world a better place. Trump is not engaging in some far-reaching Pepsi commercial to improve Russia relations with Russia and make the world a better place. That, again, is another fantasy.
Well, it seems to me that John Kennedy thought he was running the CIA, and we all saw what happened to him.
Yeah, well, you know, there's always problems, man. You know, and when it comes to the CIA and the fact that it's known that the CIA tries to influence presidential policy, and they're in a unique position to do that. They really are, and they can give a briefing to the president every day, and they can give a briefing about things that is very carefully prepared in order to nudge a president in a particular direction. But if the CIA comes to a president and it says, we want to invade the Bay of Pigs, and we've got it's all set up and we can do it, just trust us, we're going to do it well, it's still the president's decision. You know, Kennedy said, yeah, go ahead, do it. Just like Trump said yes to this operation in Yemen. And Trump is blaming Obama and the generals and said that this botched SEAL operation in Yemen had been planned before he got to office. And that when he was elected, the generals came to him, along with the CIA, and they said, we've been planning this operation, let's go. And he said, okay, go ahead, do it. Well, you know what? He said yes. And just like Kennedy said yes to the Bay of Pigs, just like Kennedy said yes to starting a secret war in Laos. I mean, he said yes. The CIA might have, you know, certainly came to him and said, we would like to do this. The Russians and the Chinese are moving into this area and we'd like to keep them out. And so Kennedy said, go ahead and do it. Whether or not the CIA assassinated John Kennedy, you know, I have no evidence that that's what happened, you know, and it's possible that rogues in the CIA did it. I'm not saying it's impossible. I can certainly see where it might have happened, but, you know, as far as I know, nobody's proved that they've done it yet, you know, and they may be really good at covering up stuff, and they may have covered it up so well that nobody ever knows. Maybe they did. I'm not saying they did. However, I don't know that they did either. And if you want to know the sorts of things that the CIA actually does, which have led me to believe that it's the organized crime branch of the United States government, and that it inflicts horrible misery on millions of people around the world, you can read my book and find out all about that stuff. But I don't know about Trump and Russia, and I don't know about the CIA bumping off Kennedy. These things may well be happening, but that's beyond the scope of my knowledge and is things that I haven't researched. And finally, the last thing to say about this is the CIA does, and I explain this in depth in the book, it doesn't work for the average American. Any more than, you know, I mean, all the working class people that I know voted for Trump because they think he's going to help the little guy. Well, I can tell you right now, when the CIA executive officers are sitting around deciding what to do, they're not thinking about helping the little guy. They're thinking about helping the corporations that run this country. And they're like the Rex Tillerson Exxon people. That's the level that the CIA works at. And the CIA considers America not to be 300 million little guys, but the 50,000 people who run this country, who own the corporations, the people in Congress, the generals who sit on the boards of these corporations. The CIA serves those people. It's a capitalist venture designed to enrich the richest people in this country, the people who have enacted the laws that have created the Department of Homeland Security, not to help the little guy, but to preserve their wealth and to increase the police repression in this country. That's the thing you have to understand about the CIA and the systems that have been organized in this country. They're not the systems that have been put in this country aren't there to help you, the little guy. They're to help the 1% or the 1% that decide everything that's going to happen, that decide foreign policy, that decide domestic policy. And every once in a while, you have to put up with people voting every 4 years. you know, and some bomb thrower like Trump can get elected, and then you have to deal with it. But they will deal with Trump, and Trump will be assimilated because Trump is a billionaire capitalist who's been part of this ruling elite all his life. And he may have some unorthodox ideas about Russia, but he will be assimilated. And the military and the CIA and the State Department within a month or two are all going to be perfectly happy with him. And Brian in the House and Mitch McConnell in the Senate will have brought him under control. They'll use him as a stalking horse to get away with his enacting as much repressive Republican legislation as they can, you know, and within the limits of their possibility. But if you want to know how the CIA functions as a tool of the rich ruling capitalist elite, then you can read my book. I don't know anything about Russia and JFK. I wish I did have some insights into that. A bunch of CIA officers I talked to thought that people in the military and the CIA may well, and in the corporate, you know, the corporate bosses may well have assassinated Kennedy. I talked to CIA guys and guys in the DEA who thought that too. But that's because they were the people that could pull that off. Work at a level, the same level of the owner as Rupert Murdoch, who owns Fox News Corporation, the same level as the people who own the New York Times, the same level as as Rex Tillerson that owned ExxonMobil, the same level as the people that own the arms industry in this country. Hewlett Packard, the big arms industry, and all the generals on their big lieutenant generals that on their payroll that sit on the boards. 50,000 people, 100,000 people that rule this country. That's where the CIA works. And the CIA, if you talk about it as the CIA wanted to do something, it couldn't do something really all that independently without having some consensus about all these people that are all, you know, at that super capitalist predator Bill Gates level. That's where, you know, and if people wanted to do a public service, make a flow chart, an organizational chart of that group. You know, then you could start seeing where power really flows in this country and see how it's connected to these people are connected to the CIA and the FBI and the military. Then you would start getting a really good understanding of how this country is run and who owns it and how they're using the CIA. But the CIA is not an entity like the Bermuda Triangle that people step into and all of a sudden they're, you know, they vanish. You know, it's got systems and the systems are in controlled by political people like Donald Trump who work within this rich capitalist elite affecting its objectives. And they convince an awful lot of millions of Americans that somehow they've got the little guy's interests in heart, and that's another big lie.
I'm speaking with researcher and author Douglas Valentine. Today's show, The Deep State as Fake News. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. You know, Doug, I was about to ask you whose agenda or what agenda is it that the CIA is carrying out? And it seems like it would be, particularly with the remarks you've just made, it would be the agenda of say, Wall Street, let's say, the big banks.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Goldman Sachs. If you want to know who the CIA works for, look at Goldman Sachs. You know, I mean, these are the people when Franklin Roosevelt created the OSS, which, you know, evolved into the CIA. He didn't go around picking little guys, normal people. You know, these are not the people considered people who have a stake in the United States. You know, they're worker bees who's, you know, if you have to give them Social Security, it's like, my God, you know, so I can't give these people Social Security. I mean, they should be working 50, 60, 70 hours a week for low wages. I mean, that's what Goldman Sachs thinks, you know, and those are the people that determine currency rates. And if they think that there's somehow the currency rate between India and China is devaluing some industry that Goldman Sachs wants to control, well, activate the CIA. Go in there, subvert India, you know, have them create some financial crisis, and now all of a sudden the exchange rate is right, and Goldman Sachs is happy, and some American corporations can move in. Or, you know, it's hard to separate American corporations because it's all now multinational corporations. You know, I mean, that people think that, you know, trade agreements are somehow anti-American. Well, look at the corporations. You know, I mean, or where do you think Toyota manufactures its cars? You know, I mean, we're being deluded. And right now, this hurricane, tornado of supposed fake news and all this talk of the deep state, which means meaningless, absolutely innocuous, meaningless term. All these terms are floating around, and people are unraveling themselves trying to figure it out. I mean, they're trying to figure out what fake news is. Well, why don't you try to figure out what's real? What's happening? You know, and study things factually. The books are there, folks. You know, you can go read them. It really, all the facts are there. It's just very frustrating to me. And, of course, like everybody, I get swept up in it. But, as confused as everybody else about what's real and what isn't real these days. But if you take a deep breath and you relax, you can figure it out. The facts are there. A fact. Donald Trump wants to destroy the Environmental Protection Agency. Okay, this is what he's going to do. He is not doing this to help the little guy. He may say he's doing it to help the little guy, but he's doing it to help corporations. You know, I mean, Obama sort of dithered around Standing Rock. It took Trump 4 days to get rid of those people. You know, this is what's going to be happening around the country. Trump is out to help the rich, political elite, and steal everything from you. That's the thing that you need to know, and that's the thing that you need to start organizing and working against, or else by the time all this fake news, deep state stuff blows over, you're going to be in prison, and your environment's going to be gone.
You write that the media organizes itself the way the CIA does, that the CIA has case officers running around the world engaged in murder and mayhem, and the media has reporters covering them. What are the similarities between the organization of the media and the organization of the CIA?
Yeah, okay. And that gets it to absolutely, well, what is America? Well, you know, America started out as a slave state. But it was always a capitalist state. The people that created our country were large landowners, you know, and they didn't like paying taxes to the British, so they created a government that initially excluded women, men who didn't own property, and blacks, of course, who the Constitution rated as 3/5 of human being. And they killed all the indigenous people on the continent. Over the course of, you know, 300 years or whatever it was, and stole everything they had. That is the ethic. These are the ethics that define the United States of America. And that since the country was created, as it's sort of liberalized, systems have been put in place to maintain the status and prerogatives of the ruling class, the same kind of ruling class that created this country. And as it expands, laws, tax laws, property laws, all kind of, you know, a whole starting in the beginning of the 20th century, you know, departments of justice, customs, all these different systems are put in place. And the systems are all designed to protect the interests of this rich ruling class. And while we don't have slavery anymore, it took until the 1960s to get rid of the Jim Crow laws. And segregation. And of course, we're still a segregated country. You know, I mean, that still exists. And black people are still pitted against poor white people, just like they were when the country was created. And all these systems are in place, but now they're more highly bureaucratized, Technocrats run them. They're in place and they're so deep, it seems like you can't see them, although you can feel them and you can see the results of them all the time. And one of the systems that's evolved in the 250 years that we've been around is the system of information, of how we view our country, what we know about it. And the same way that the rich ruling elite has controlled and structured all these other systems. And believe me, it wasn't the little guy that put these systems in place. It was the rich political elite that puts all these systems in place. They have put in systems of media management. Okay. And in this sense, the media serves basically the same function as the CIA, which is a system, or the military, which is a system, or the education system, which of course is part of the media. And as you know, if you went to school, you grew up being told that America was the greatest country on the earth, and you probably weren't told about slavery, and you probably weren't told about a lot of things that anything that diminished America's stature in your little adolescent mind. And you grew up believing all these myths about America as the land of opportunity and the country that's going to bring democracy to the world. And in the meantime, it's got this hidden CIA and it's waging war. And it's got the biggest military in the world, a military that's bigger than all the other militaries of the world combined. And yet you still think it's a victim, and you got to worry about ISIS and Muslims and Mexican immigrants. Well, why is this? Because a system of media management has been put in place and has evolved over 250 years as well. And that's the system of media management, which extends into education and everything else that you learn, and Hollywood and TV especially, which is the ultimate, because as the little guy, your only function is to buy commodities that the capitalists produce at outrageous rates. And buy commodities that you don't need, have no value to your, have no intrinsic value to your life, but simply pollute the environment and make your life worse. But TV ads make you think that all this stuff is fine. And when you see people on TV, you say, God, I want to be like him. I want to be like Meryl Streep, or I want to be like Paul Newman. You know, I mean, and I could live that life, you know, and these systems, which not just TV and the movies and education system, but the daily news that you get. All these things are controlled. They're a system that are controlled the same way that the CIA is controlled. And at the very highest levels of the media, they are the CIA. And that's why they don't tell you about the CIA, because that's their part in the overall spectacle, is not to tell you about these things so you continue to believe all these myths about America, and not just myths about America, but most importantly, myths about yourself that you've learned through your education, through what you see on TV, and that as soon as Nike comes out with a new pair of sneakers, boom, off you go and you buy it. And maybe you're a Pepsi guy, or maybe you're a Coke guy, you know, but you like Pepsi and you like Coke because, like Trump, they say they want good relations with Russia. You know, and so you know, it's all the systems that have been in place are elaborate, and they've evolved over 200 years, but they all have the same purpose. And that's why I say in the book, at the highest levels, the CIA is the same as the media. And the way you rise from, you know, a lowly entry-level person in the CIA to head the CIA is the same way you rise up through, you know, the New York Times, for example. You know, you start out as a cub reporter, and if you write articles that show that you have an aptitude for disclosing, for covering up the things that Americans shouldn't know, and telling them the things that they should know, the way they should know it, well, then maybe you'll become a more important reporter. You know, and then if you really, they might let you actually have contact with a CIA officer. You know, and up you go until through all these ideological, you know, tests that are given to you, until, you know, someday you're in executive management and you're actually talking to guys in the CIA executive management, and they're telling you, well, you know, in about 2 years, we're going to be overthrowing the government of the Philippines, you know, which we really don't like right now because they've been bad to Westinghouse. And Westinghouse wants to build a nuclear reactor in one of their provinces. And there's a bunch of congressmen there. And we're getting rid of them, by the way. But when we do, you know, there's going to be room for you guys there, and you're going to get a news bureau and stuff like that. I mean, that's what goes on at these highest levels. And these people at the highest level have no blinders over their eyes. They have no illusions. They're all in it together as a mafia. And again, it's hard to explain these things in 20 minutes or 40 minutes or an hour. And even the book, this book, The CIA's Organized Crime, how its operations corrupt everything. And that's corruption in the sense of corrupting you so that you don't know who you are. You're not even in touch with your humanity or the humanity of, you know, say if you're, you know, you might have feelings about blacks, or you might have, if you're black, you might have feelings about Mexicans. I mean, how the information you receive is through the media is making you feel these things. If you want to understand those kind of things, read my book. You know, some of these other things that you talk about, I don't know anything about, but very realistically, you know, the book outlines how that works, how that system's work. And, you know, it has to do with capitalism and the ideology that capitalism advances, which is, you know, that you know, 1% of the 1% of the 1% are the big dogs, and they deserve everything because they take it.
Thank you so much, Doug.
Okay, Bonnie. Oh, thanks for letting me ramble on, and I hope I haven't disappointed too many of your listeners.
I've been speaking with Douglas Valentine. Today's show has been The Deep State as Fake News. Douglas Valentine is the author of several works of historical nonfiction, including The Phoenix Program, America's Use of Terror in Vietnam, About the CIA in Vietnam, and The Strength of the Wolf and the Strength of the Pack, which discuss the history of federal drug law enforcement. He also edited a poetry anthology, With Our Eyes Wide Open, Poems of the New American Century. His latest book is The CIA as Organized Crime, How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World, available at claritypress.com. Visit his website at douglasvalentine.com. That's douglasvalentine.com. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yara Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Jill Stein on the predatory Republicrat Party, on how the citizens have been getting a bad deal for years, and on how change can come at the grassroots. Workers, arise, and please stay tuned. About 4 weeks back, our show featured Chris Hedges and Bernie Sanders. Hedges was speaking at a rally in Washington, D.C. on the day after Inauguration Day 2017. Today, we'll hear another voice from that same rally. Possibly it's a voice you've never heard before, the voice of Jill Stein. Since Stein was the candidate for president from the Green Party and on the ballot in many states, how come almost nobody knows her voice? Silly question. Only voices approved by the Republicrat establishment monopoly get heard in presidential debates, on TV news programs, and alas, even on most public radio. Meanwhile, the Republicrat Neoliberal Committee gave us a pair of presidential candidates that, by every poll, was the least liked, most despised duo of political hacks ever selected. Bernie Sanders would have won the presidential election had the Democratic Party allowed him to get the nomination. But no, Wall Street wanted their loyal and trusted servant, Hillary Clinton, and what Lola wants, Lola gets. Lola being Spanish for Wall Street, I think. Anyway, by all accounts, the corporate media over-publicized Donald Trump, under-publicized Bernie Sanders, and Jill Stein. Who ever heard of Jill Stein? Well, nobody would if the corporate media had their way, and they pretty much did have their way. Jill Ellen Stein was born in Chicago in 1950. She was raised a Reform Jew. She now considers herself an agnostic. She graduated magna cum laude from Harvard College, received an M.D. from Harvard Medical School, and practiced internal medicine in the Boston area for the next 25 years. For decades, she has been active in progressive politics and in progressive organizations. She is a board member of Physicians for Social Responsibility and a member of other worthy groups. She ran for governor of Massachusetts in 2002 and 2010, but lost both times. She was the Green Party candidate for U.S. president in 2012 and 2016. This is a pretty substantial progressive resume, to my way of thinking. To my mind, that beats serving on the board of directors of Walmart and giving speeches to Wall Street fat cats for $250,000 a pop. Or was it $500,000? I remember, during the campaign for the Democratic Party nomination, Hillary Clinton said words to the effect of, "Elect me, President, because that would be precedent-shattering, the first woman president." To this, Bernie Sanders replied, "Well, electing me president would be pretty precedent-shattering, too." I assume he meant he'd be our first Jewish president. Well, obviously, this was a false dichotomy. No need to play either-or. You could vote for Jill Stein and kill two birds with one stone. Possibly, Bernie meant not that he'd be the first Jewish president, but rather the first socialist president. But the only person who thinks Bernie Sanders is a socialist is Bernie Sanders, and perhaps the John Birch Society. Sanders is a liberal Democrat. If he's the most radical leftist in Congress, we're in very serious trouble. And indeed, we are. I think Jill is to the left of Bernie, and she articulates her position with intelligence, clarity, and grace. I do think that Bernie Sanders is the best of the Democrats. That's not high praise, but it is praise. But as Jill Stein reminds us, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party are two sides of the same counterfeit coin. That's my metaphor, not Jill's. Speaking in D.C. on January 21, 2017, here is Dr. Jill Stein.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thanks to everybody. Thanks to Socialist Alternative and Green Party. And thanks to all of you for coming out tonight. And above all, thank you for standing up in order to unite and to fight, which is what we have to do right now. So I would say welcome to the resistance. But for most of you, you've already been here. This is not new. This is just building on what has been, you know, kind of in the cards for quite some time. And as awful, you know, despicable, scary as this moment is, at least, you know, at least the veil has come off. And, you know, whether we were heading for a slow demise, you know, being strangled by neoliberalism under the Democratic Party, or whether we are actually engaging the battle right now, facing this neo-fascist administration, we were kind of going to the same place. So, you know, I personally, you know, I find this a sobering moment, but, you know, am not feeling surprised. In fact, I'm actually a little bit surprised that there is as much clarity and as much resistance on the streets here at ground zero of the new, you know, era of the billionaire takeover. I've been very pleasantly surprised, I have to say, just being out on the streets, that people are not saying, at least where I've been, which was largely around Franklin Park yesterday, from what I saw yesterday, you know, it really felt there was such a hunger out on the streets for discussion and for talk and for just really kind of soul searching about where do we go from here. And I was really delighted not to hear, you know, well, we just got to work harder and get back with the Democratic Party and that's the solution. People are really recognizing that Donald Trump really is a symbol of this predatory, bipartisan political system brought to us by predatory banks and fossil fuel giants and war profiteers. Donald Trump is the face of that bipartisan system. And we must reject not just Donald Trump and the Republicans, we must also reject the Democrats as well. And I am encouraged by, you know, by this massive march today, by yesterday's resistance, by the walkouts from high schools and colleges across the country, by the strike of the longshoremen on the West Coast, which needs to be a symbol for us all, and I think a tactic we are going to be standing on. Lifted up and encouraged by the fight of the indigenous leaders at Standing Rock. the many fights that are following in suit against the pipelines in Memphis, in Texas, and really all around the country, that on so many fronts people are standing up for nothing short, you know, of an America and a world that works for all of us. I think we have seen that the piecemeal solutions, the window dressing on a burning house, you know, is not what unifies people, is not what brings us out, is not what engages people in struggle. We need to be really standing up for a transformative agenda that puts people, planet, and peace over profit, and nothing less than that. This election, I think, was no surprise, an incredibly toxic election, which had a very toxic consequence. More degraded by big money and corporate profiteering in terms of media coverage, billions of dollars worth of free media delivered, particularly to Donald Trump, with the approval and encouragement of the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, that was lifting up Donald Trump and Ted Cruz and looking to make the Republican candidate as fringe and lunatic as possible in order to help Hillary's chances. You know, this was an extremely corrupt election, which was the product of corrupt politics and a corrupt media, and it produced the most disliked, untrusted candidates for president among the mainstream parties in our history. So this was not a Republican triumph, it was a bipartisan failure. The majority of Donald Trump's voters were not voting for Donald Trump. This was shown in poll after poll. Donald Trump's voters were largely voting against Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party and their track record for bailing out Wall Street, not only bailing out Wall Street, but dismantling Wall Street regulation to start with and exporting our jobs and creating wars without end that are blowing back at us. At the same time, they are depleting our budget, costing us half of our discretionary budget for these wars that have only created failed states, mass refugee migrations, and worse terrorist threats. So people were saying, we've had enough. We are rejecting both of these corrupt corporate parties. 80% of people said that they were disgusted by this election. 90% registered in a poll last spring in the midst of the election, saying 90% saying they had lost faith in our political system, in the executive, in Congress, in the judiciary, really across the board. We have had a massive rejection and repudiation of this political system. 75% of people were screaming for other alternatives in this election and were calling for open debates, which is why part of the struggle going forward is to have a people's debate commission and end this corporate controlled bipartisan scam of a debate. And 60% of people have been calling for a new major political party, and it's long past time to do that. And as well, so many people who were yearning for something else but who were intimidated by being terrified of either Hillary Clinton, because a lot of people have had it with the Democrats, or they were terrified by Donald Trump and the reality of what he represents. So we have a system in which the main question on people's minds in going to the polls was, who do you hate the most? And who are you most afraid of? And guess what? The politics of fear delivered everything we were afraid of. We need a new politics of courage going forward, and we need a voting system that actually liberates us to vote our values and not to feel constrained by our fears. We need ranked choice voting. And the state of Maine actually passed ranked choice voting, which really charts the course for us all. We can all pass ranked choice voting in every state. It doesn't require congressional legislation, and it can be done with a voter referendum, which is how it was done in Maine, because the Democratic and Republican-controlled legislatures are never going to let it out of the bag. In fact, in California, Jerry Brown recently vetoed a bill that would have allowed ranked choice voting at the municipal level. And why don't they want it? Because it would actually force their hand. They would have to fish or cut bait. They would actually have to stand up for what they're for instead of just being slightly less worse than the Republicans. They would actually have to engage in a real debate. And the reality is, they don't support us. They do not support a progressive agenda. And ranked choice voting really calls their bluff. They will not support it because they basically do not support us, the voters. And in my view, the fact that the Democratic Party has consistently fought against ranked choice voting says that they do not support us and they do not deserve your vote on that basis alone. Rise to power is clearly the product of economic despair caused by the neoliberal policies of both parties. And, you know, those policies that gave us these lousy, part-time, insecure, low-wage jobs. Anybody familiar with those kinds of jobs out there? This is like 90% of the jobs that have been created since the Wall Street crash. Are these low-wage jobs. So people who are new in the job market, that is millennials, are really getting the short end of the stick here, which is why you don't have to be persuaded, you know, that the system is corrupt. The challenge with millennials is to just let you know that there is another option out there that actually stands up for what you need in order to survive. It's not only the jobs, it's the poverty level wages. It's that generation of young people locked into predatory student loan debt without a way out. And by the way, the number of young people locked into student loan debt alone is enough to win a three-way presidential race or a three-way race at our local levels and for legislatures and so on. And student debt is not just a national issue. It is a local and a state issue. And anyone running for office at that local or state level can actually be an advocate to your state legislature, to your college system, to reduce student the costs of student fees and tuition right now, so that we can actually run campaigns locally based on the same agenda, which have the same potential to really capture majoritarian support here. And because you're running at a local level, it is more possible to actually knock on doors, mobilize people, and to actually win these races. And I'll come back to that in a moment about where we go from here. But just to make the point that the rise of Donald Trump, yes, it has everything to do with racism and misogyny and xenophobia and all of that, but in times of great economic crisis that we see the dark side rising up and we see demagogues who play us on our fears. So it's really important, I think, for us to stand up to address that crisis that has forced people to their backs against the wall to where we are essentially engaging in blaming the victim right now. This didn't come out of nowhere. This comes very much out of the economic crisis, which we can very much lay at the feet of the Democrats every bit as much as the Republicans here. The Democrats are every bit as culpable. So, you know, I'm basically driving home that the response here, the real effective response, is not cleaving to the Democrats as the voice of opposition or as the alternative here. We are the alternative, independent, people-powered politics under the lights of the Green Party and the Socialist Alternative. It is we, independent political parties that are not corporate-sponsored, that are actually engaged right now at the local level, as Shama Sawant is, as Gail McLaughlin has been in Richmond, California, where they've also done really amazing and wonderful things. This is what you're not supposed to know about, because if you know about this, then we don't sit quiet and allow ourselves to be sidelined. And I'll just mention, back in 2002, the first time I ran for office against Mitt Romney, running for governor in Massachusetts, we fought our way into a televised debate. It took place in a TV studio, no live audience. And by giving voice to this radical progressive agenda, at that time, when things weren't as bad as they are right now, inside the TV studio, it went over like a lead balloon. But when I walked out of the TV studio, I was mobbed by the press, who told me that I had won the debate on the instant online viewer poll. And it, in a flash, made me realize we're actually not the odd man out here. We actually are the heart and soul of American values, which are to say human values, people values, workers values, women's values. That's who we are. And the corporate media and our corporate political parties may try to tell us otherwise, but you know, that's just not the case. So it's important, I think, for us to go forward from a position of strength, not from a position of apology that we are asking too much, or that, you know, aren't we being presumptuous by thinking that students should be bailed out. You know, it's only the Wall Street bankers who get bailed out, but not a generation of young people who are the victims of Wall Street. That's absolute nonsense. You know, it's time for us to bail out the students. We can afford to do that. We can afford it for Wall Street. We can afford it for young people. Great, okay. So let me just conclude here by saying that this is a presidency, you know, whether to even call it legitimate or illegitimate, you know, shall we say there are problems with our voting system, which are longstanding, and no less in this election, but certainly this president violates our basic tenets of our Constitution, our civil liberties, our civil rights, our basic sense of justice, the War Powers Act, etc., the right of the legislature to declare war, and so on. This president stands in violation of our basic principles, our ethics guidelines, our laws around conflicts of interest. This president enters his administration with a playing field very steeply tilted against him. That's not to say he isn't capable of sending us all to oblivion with the flick of a switch. He is, but at the same time, it's important to remember how incredibly embattled this president is. His support ratings are going down by the hour. He's absolutely unprepared and unequipped to do this job. As of yesterday, they had appointed all of 29 people among the 600 executive appointments that they have to make. They don't have a clue, not even how to run a modern business or to sit on a board of directors, which they do not have. You know, this is a sort of a family mafia running a family business, or call them an aristocracy or whatever they are. They are not capable of even administering our state. As compromised as it is, they are not up to the job. And they are going to continue failing madly, embarrassing themselves, embarrassing all of us in the world community. So they are going to be very hamstrung, there's no doubt about it, in legal challenges, constitutional challenges. This is an impeachment waiting to happen. And remember, whether there's an impeachment or not, corrupt governments have been brought down, and they've also been brought to heel. Many of us here will remember what happened under Richard Nixon, one of the most corrupt and regressive, repressive presidents in our history. We brought the troops home from Vietnam. We created the EPA, we passed the Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act. We achieved women's right to choose from a very conservative Supreme Court. We created OSHA for occupational safety and health, protection of workers. All of this we did under an extremely repressive and violent regime. We did that because, why? Our lives were on the line. Our brothers, particularly our brothers of color, but young people as well, were being sent to die in Vietnam. Well, our lives are on the line again. And whether it's from the violence against African Americans, the pending deportations of immigrants, whether it is a generation locked in debt without a future, or the meltdown of the climate, which is happening on our watch in our lifetimes, with latest climate science saying maybe we have a couple of decades before we see tens of feet of sea level rise, absolutely unsustainable for civilization as we know it. Our lives are on the line. That's extremely motivating. We have the numbers. We have the solutions. We have the power. It's time to get organized. When we stand up with the power that we do have, we can create an America and a world that works for all of us, that puts people, planet, and peace over profit. This is the time to get organized around the issues, to get organized in our communities, and to get organized fundamentally, politically, because that's where we come together to achieve critical mass, to say no to the divide and conquer regimen that they're trying to force on us to have us work on our favorite issue alone, in which we will all be divided and conquered. A political party that is a real political party is essentially a coalition over time, over issues, over geography, with a clear agenda. We have that agenda. It's an agenda for people, planet, and peace over profit. It is not an agenda of window dressing, of marginal changes around a crisis. We have a crisis. The world is going up in flames, and we are in the middle of it. But we have the numbers that it takes, and we have the vision and the passion to do it. We are the ones we've been waiting for. Let's make it happen. Thank you so much.
Back to back on New World Notes, two progressive activists who happen to be women and happen to be physicians. Last week, Dr. Helen Caldicott. This week, Dr. Jill Stein. I don't want to glorify physicians in general. An MD doesn't make you any more progressive than a barber's license does. We now have a right-wing ideologue confirmed as Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Dr. Benjamin Carson, MD. A fairly distinguished pediatric neurosurgeon by trade. What's the connection between pediatric neurosurgery and housing and urban development, you cry? Well, it's obvious. Pediatric neurosurgeons tend to work in urban areas and tend to live in really nice houses. So, Carson for housing and urban development. So many of Trump's other cabinet choices were so bizarre, Dr. Carson seemed almost like a sane appointment by comparison. Actually, I know a former pediatric neurologist in Hartford, and he's a very sweet guy. Perhaps they'll appoint him Postmaster General. But I digress. Independent, non-commercial radio and video producer Wilton Vaught captured Stein's talk live, and he kindly shared the recording, which I have gently edited. Many thanks to Wilton. Find more of his work at his website, othervoicesotherchoices.com. And many thanks to you for listening. You can find more of our work at our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. On behalf of the entire New World Notes staff, that's me, myself, and our Moscow correspondents, Mike Flynn and Jeff Sessions, on behalf of the entire staff, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimi non carborundum, you are not alone, keep the aspidistra flying, and let's try to live each day as though the truth were true. Ciao.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl.
Today on the show, we'll be discussing the falsely justified by 9/11 global war on terror in Syria, and in particular, the White Helmets, now of Oscar-winning fame for a short documentary award given at the Oscars on February 26th. Are the White Helmets really this great humanitarian organization, rescuing Syrian civilians, or are they something much more sinister? Let's take a look. First, if you've been paying attention, you know that Al-Qaeda and now ISIS were created and supported by the U.S. and several of their allies. First to fight the Russians in Afghanistan in the 80s, then they were used in the breakup of the former Yugoslavia, then they were in places in Africa, including Libya, and now Syria. Al-Qaeda supposedly attacked us on 9/11. But the evidence doesn't support that claim. But that propaganda was useful in starting the global war on terror, allowing the U.S. and its allies to invade, destroy, and occupy several countries in the Middle East. The plans to attack these countries were revealed right after 9/11 and reported to us by General Wesley Clark.
About 10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the Joint Staff who had used to work for me. And one of the generals called me and he said, "Sir, you got to come in. You got to come in and talk to me a second." I said, "Well, you're too busy." He said, No. He says, "We've made the decision. We're going to war with Iraq." This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, "We're going to war with Iraq. Why?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "I guess they don't know what else to do." So I said, "Well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to Al-Qaeda?" He said, No. He says, "There's nothing new that way. They just made the decision to go to war with Iraq." He said, "I guess it's like we don't know what to do about terrorists, but we've got a good military and we can take down governments." And he said, "I guess if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem has to look like a nail." So I came back to see him a few weeks later, and by that time we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, "Are we still going to war with Iraq?" And he said, "Oh, it's worse than that." He said, he reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper, and he said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office today, and he said, "This is a memo that describes how we're going to take out seven countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran."
General Wesley Clark revealed this when he was on a book tour in 2007. So these wars in the Middle East were pre-planned, at least as early as September 2001. Have you ever heard General Wesley Clark's revelations on the corporate media? More accurately described, I think, as the fake media? I haven't. Another important point in all of this is to understand that many NGOs are actually being funded by foundations and have become compromised or co-opted to do the bidding of the U.S. government and its allies. And that brings us to the White Helmets. According to investigative journalist Rick Sterling, in an article posted on the great Canadian website globalresearch.ca, he says, quote, "The White Helmets are a feel-good story, like a Disney hero movie, 90% myth and fabrication. Most of what is claimed about the Syrian rescue group is untrue. They are not primarily Syrian. The group was initiated by British military contractor James Lemessurier and has been heavily funded by the USA, UK, and other governments." Most of the heavy funding goes to marketing, which is run by the Syrian Campaign based in New York. The manager is an Irish-American woman, Anna Nolan, who has never been to Syria. When Eastern Aleppo was finally freed from the armed militants, it was discovered that the White Helmets' headquarters were alongside the headquarters of the Al-Qaeda Syrian militant group. Civilians from East Aleppo reported that the White Helmets primarily responded when the militants were attacked. Soon after departing Aleppo in government-supplied buses, the White Helmets showed up in the mountains above Damascus, where they allied with terrorist groups in poisoning, then shutting off the water source for 5 million people in Damascus. The White Helmets' claim to be neutral and independent is another lie. They only work in areas controlled by the rebel groups, primarily Nusra and Al-Qaeda. Their leaders actively call for U.S. and NATO intervention in Syria. The movie is as fraudulent as the group it tries to heroize. This raises the question regarding the integrity of the Oscar Academy Awards. Are awards given for actual quality, authenticity, skill, and passion? Or are Oscar awards sometimes given under political and financial influence? There is political motivation to promote the White Helmets as part of the effort to prevent the collapse of the Western Israeli Gulf campaign to overthrow the Syrian government. And now you'll hear a video on the White Helmets created by HandsOffSyriaSydney.com.
The White Helmets, also known as Syrian Civil Defense, claim to be an impartial non-government organization campaigning for Syrians. But despite the name, the White Helmets was not created by Syrians, nor does it serve Syria. Meet James Lemessurier, a consultant for the UK Foreign and Commonwealth Office and former British Army officer. So what is a non-Syrian British foreign policy consultant doing establishing a NGO in a foreign country? Does James really have the Syrian people's best interests at heart? If so, why do the White Helmets operate solely in terrorist-held areas? Why has the White Helmets constantly called for the implementation of a NATO-imposed no-fly zone? The same kind of no-fly zone that has destroyed Libya for decades. A no-fly zone in Syria would only benefit those who seek regime change and ultimately hurt the Syrians who are already targeted by illegal sanctions. The fact is, the White Helmets are nothing but a propaganda tool for the US and UK administrations to justify military action against the Syrian government. But the White Helmets insist on being impartial and unarmed. Here's where it gets interesting. Meet Raed Saleh. He currently leads the White Helmets inside Syria. He was set to accept an award from Interaction, an alliance of international aid agencies, but was refused entry into the US due to his visa being cancelled for unknown reasons. 27th of April 2016, US Deputy Spokesperson Mark Toner was confronted by journalist Matt Lee about the White House's inconsistency regarding the White Helmets.
You commend this group, you're going to continue to support them, and yet you revoked the visa of their leader? That makes zero sense to me. What's exactly...
And then when asked who funded and supported the White Helmets, Mark replies...
Well, I can tell you that we provide through USAID about $23 million in assistance to them.
$23 million. Wait a second. Are the White Helmets not, and I quote, fiercely independent and accepts no money from governments? So we have seen a group who is clearly not Syrian, not impartial and not independent, who are armed and are most certainly sectarian. The White Helmets. An NGO? Or simply Al-Qaeda with a facelift?
And now we'll hear from Canadian journalist Eva Bartlett in an interview she did with Sean Stone.
In terms of the demonization of the Syrian army and government, this is all part of the process of trying to convince the Western public to back Western administrations in supporting groups like the White Helmets, which pretend to be Syrian rescuers, but which have received over $20 million from the U.S., $20 million from the U.K., and $60 million, together from various EU states. And what they're essentially doing, these White Helmets, and I really want to stress this point because it's part of the overall scheme of propaganda and demonization. They're White Helmets by day and terrorists by night. You see many of these people that are dressed in their pristine white outfits and white helmets that pretend to be rescuing civilians. In other instances, you see the same characters holding their weapons and posing as rebels. These have been well documented by various authors, including my colleague Vanessa Bealey. And this is the scandalous hypocrisy of the West. Not only has the West been funding and training and arming terrorists to go into Syria and to behead and slaughter Syrian civilians, but now the West wants to award the White Helmets with the Nobel Peace Prize. And this, again, is a group of terrorists that operate solely in terrorist districts of Idlib and eastern Aleppo. And they have been known to pose with the dead bodies of Syrian soldiers. They are not neutral. They are not impartial. But they are surely a tool of propaganda and regime change. So back to the bigger picture. The bigger picture is not about Syrian security. Because if it was, then the West and the Gulf, well, let's just stick with the West, would have to respect the fact that the Syrian people have chosen their government. Even if they want political change in the future, right now they want the current government they have. They want security. They want an end to the West and Gulf and Israel and Turkey sending terrorists in to murder them. They want stability. They want an end of the sanctions that is suffocating them. And they don't want Western intervention. And they, above all, do not want a no-fly zone. And if you watch corporate media now, you'll see that this is what the White Helmets are calling for. This is what so-called unarmed civilians, unnamed activists in eastern Aleppo are calling for. And we've seen what a no-fly zone does to countries. When they no-fly zoned Libya, it was the beginning of the end of Libya, and Syrians do not want that.
And now we'll hear a clip from Russia Today with journalists Lizzie Phelan and Vanessa Bealey. It starts out at the Oscars.
White Helmets.
Thank you to the White Helmets.
Sadly, Raed Salah, the head of the White Helmets, is not able to join us tonight.
Well, they came into the spotlight during the siege of Aleppo when they were operating in the rebel-held part of the city. Many do view them as heroes, putting themselves on the line to save lives. However, the documentary does ignore some concerns about how the White Helmets operate after their reputation came under fire for a number of incidents. Well, our correspondent in Syria, Lizzie Phelan, gave us her reaction to the documentary's Oscar and told us how people in the city of Aleppo view the White Helmets.
The White Helmets receiving this Oscar really is just the pinnacle of the love and adoration that they have been receiving now for some time by the Western media industry and politicians. Of course, they have been, before producing this documentary, they've been producing videos of the rescue operations that the Western media have lapped up almost without question. And those videos have been funded to the tune of millions by Western governments, including the American, the British, and the French governments. But there's been many very serious allegations leveled at the White Helmets about some of their activities. And that main allegation is that the White Helmets, rather than being a benign humanitarian organization, are in fact almost exclusively a support service for extremist organizations that have been fighting against the Syrian government, including one of the most extreme organizations in Syria, the Fatah al-Sham Front, formerly named the al-Nusra Front and linked to al-Qaeda. There have been many photos and videos circulating online of the White Helmets members alongside these extremist groups. I was in Aleppo during the most intense fighting there as the army was battling to retake the city from the opposition. At the time, the White Helmets were releasing several videos, apparently, of their rescue operations. So I decided to speak to some of the thousands of civilians who were fleeing at the time from rebel-held territory to ask them if they knew who the White Helmets were, what their impressions of them were. And frankly, I spoke to many, many people, and not one of them gave me a positive impression of the organization.
You ever see in Fardus men with white helmets? They're called the White Helmets or the civil defense, helping people when they were injured.
When they came to help the injured, they stole from them. If people were wearing jewelry, they cut it off. All of them are thieves.
This man accused the organization of intentionally killing his little girl.
I took her to the civil defense hospital and they gave her an injection filled with air to kill her.
They don't help people. They only work when there is a camera on them, and when the camera is gone, they leave. They abandon people under the rubble. They told us to pull the bodies out by ourselves.
So very, very serious allegations there, along with the many other negative claims that have been made over the White Helmets over a course of some time now. And quite shocking that none of these allegations have been investigated by the White Helmets. White Helmets backers, and now not only have they been allowed to be nominated for an Oscar, but they've actually gone on to win this very prestigious award without any investigation of these allegations.
There's a feeling there. Well, here are some more examples of the controversy surrounding the group. Members of the White Helmets being spotted at executions, for example, carried out by jihadists. The group was also caught producing fake reports, too, like this one, in which it claimed that Russian jets had killed civilians. It turned out that the photograph was taken before Russian warplanes began flying in Syria. The White Helmets' credibility was more heavily scrutinised, too, after it staged a so-called mannequin challenge, faking the rescue of a person from rubble. We also discussed the White Helmets Oscar with Vanessa Bealey, an independent researcher and journalist. She was sceptical about why the documentary was even nominated for the Academy Award.
They should be congratulated maybe on their acting skills rather than their humanitarian skills. We were asking the civilians what they knew of the White Helmets. Most of the civilians didn't have a clue who we were talking about. When we then expanded on the theme and we mentioned that they were civil defence, then almost immediately the response was, ah, you mean Nusra Front's civil defence.
Well, the leader of the White Helmets and one of the documentary's cinematographers weren't able to attend the Oscars ceremony. The media, though, was quick to blame President Trump's temporary travel ban for that. However, the group had a very different explanation. In an official statement, the White Helmets say that there's simply too much work to do in Syria, and the cameraman couldn't attend the award ceremony as the Syrian government has cancelled his passport.
And now you're going to hear three journalists speaking about the White Helmets on the RT show called Crosstalk, hosted by Peter Lavelle. The first one is independent investigative journalist Vanessa Bealey.
I had a very interesting 4 weeks in Syria, including some time spent in West Aleppo. Let's have a look, first of all, at the concept of the White Helmets. They claim that they are they're an NGO. They're not funded by any governments, particularly by governments that have a vested interest in the conflict in Syria. That's the number one lie. They receive probably in the region of conservatively $100 million. Primary funder is the UK Foreign Office, followed by the United States via USAID, which we know from their history to be very much connected to deep state in America and an outreach agent for CIA infiltration into target nations. So that's the first black mark against the White Helmets. What you're definitely seeing is very much what happened in Iraq, is the stealth eradication of the Syrian state and the Syrian state institutions. And the White Helmets are a huge part of this. If we look again at the funding, conservatively 100 million going into an organization of 3,000 operatives. Actually, just to go back to what Ava said as well about Kafrai and Fua, these so-called neutral, impartial operatives funded by the U.S. coalition fundamentally that is has a heavily vested interest in regime change in Syria. During the Madaya crisis, or the manufactured Madaya crisis, they were seen holding up banners calling for the devastation and destruction of Kafrai and Fur, the two Idlib villages that Ava just mentioned. But very quickly, it's very important at this point to point out their role in shadow state building by intelligence, British intelligence, and by U.S. intelligence. There is an existing Syria civil defense. It was created in 1953. It was a founder member of the ICDO, the International Civil Defense Organization. And just to give you a very brief update on what happened yesterday, we discovered yesterday that the ICDO website link to the Syrian Arab Republic Syria civil defense had been infiltrated, let's say, and the link was in fact linking to the White Helmets website. Now, that wasn't like that about a week ago. So after various emails and phone calls to the ICDO, I managed to speak to them this morning. And in fact, the person that I spoke to appeared to be horrified. He said it was an administration mistake. And they admitted to me that the white helmets are not recognized by the ICDO. They're not recognized by the UN as a civil defense organization. The only recognized organization inside Syria is the Syria Civil Defense, the real Syria Civil Defense. So not only are the white helmets questionable on their funding and on their independence, and they're trained in Turkey, not in Syria. They're embedded in Nusra Front and ISIS-held areas and various other brigades of terrorists under various names. They're also now proven to be attempting to usurp the existence of the real Syria Civil Defense. And through the testimony of the real Syria Civil Defense that I spoke to, the crews in various governorates in Syria, they not only usurped them, they killed them when they took over the centers, the real Syria Civil Defense centers in Deir ez-Zor, in Raqqa, in Idlib, in East Aleppo, and they stole their equipment. There are numerous videos out there of them participating in the capture of civilians, in the beating, in the torture of civilians. Their operatives have been known to post to their social media sites videos of the torture and the public execution of prisoners of war, Syrian Arab Army soldiers. We were told that that one particular operative was sacked, but no official statement was made by this humanitarian NGO to condemn a public execution and torture of prisoners of war, which contravenes every single Geneva Convention that exists on the rules of war. And there was a further execution of a civilian in Aleppo, which was filmed, where basically the white helmets came in as a mop-up operation. You know, and then add to that the testimony from the real Syria Civil Defense. We're not just seeing an outreach organization for the States and the UK. We're seeing an organization that's embedded in terrorist areas and is supporting and facilitating terrorist activity. And if you look at what the UK government is creating, along with the Free Syria Police, taxpayers' money is going heavily into the creation of this shadow state in Syria. And this shadow state in Syria is destroying the existing state institutions in order to secure its own existence.
And next you'll hear Patrick Henningsen, journalist, writer, and founder of the website 21stCenturyWire.com.
There has to be a level of skepticism in journalism and the media, because clearly you're not going to get it from government. That's for certain. Our government has proven time and time again that it's willing to go to any depth. It's willing to lie, cheat, to deceive the public. This is proven fact. This is history, okay? And they've proven that. So where's the fourth estate? Where's the media? There has to be a level of skepticism in looking at these images and saying, what exactly are we looking here? And, you know, having worked in first aid, having, you know, being certified International Red Cross person in the past for work, I've done first aid. I've had to use backboards for spinal injuries. You never see any of this in any of their videos. It's just man holding child over the shoulder and then the dramatic well-lit picture. And some of these videos, you can look at them and any normal person who's in video editing will see it's heavily edited for the money shot, and also that it's unauthentic completely. You could say that it's fake or staged in many cases. We posted these online for people to look at, and most people are saying, agreeing, yes, some of these are staged. So even if a few of them are fake, and these are being used to influence public perception, to get the public behind regime change or behind an escalation of war by the United States and its coalition, then this is a big problem. Then there's a level of deception going on here. And then to parlay that into a Nobel Peace Prize is just on another level. I think if they do win the Nobel Peace Prize, it'll be the end of the Nobel Peace Prize. Because there's so much evidence out there. There's so much visual forensic evidence that point to this being a group that is not exactly what it's being sold as.
And now here's independent investigative journalist Eva Bartlett.
Almost no Syrian that I met knew of the white helmets. The only people that were aware were people that had some sort of interest in media and the media scams and the shams that are going on. So if you ask the average Syrian, including in Aleppo, I should note, and including doctors in the Aleppo Medical Association, they aren't aware of the white helmets. So clearly this is not an organization that's representing the Syrian people. I think there's an interesting note, too. You know, the UN Security Council passed the resolution 2253 and then 24 hours later 2254. Essentially, 2253 was about cutting the funding and support and training of terrorists, and 2254 was more focused on a political solution, which the Western nations have taken to use as a way of regime-changing Syria. But 2253 is essential before there can be any peace in Syria. 2253, the ending of funding of terrorists, must end. And this actually applies to the White Helmets. You have to stop funding these propagandists who are also, in many instances, as my colleagues have said, holding weapons and participating in acts of violence against Syrian civilians.
So you've just heard from several different independent investigative journalists who have actually been in Syria discuss the White Helmets. The short documentary about them, called The White Helmets, just won an Oscar. The propaganda comes at us from many different sources. If these journalists are correct, and the White Helmets really are working with Al-Qaeda in Syria, and I have no reason to doubt them, then that would mean that the U.S., U.K., and other Western countries are now funding and supporting the terrorists who supposedly did 9/11. So in a sense, Al-Qaeda just won an Oscar. And in case you think I'm crazy when I say that the U.S. is funding the terrorists in Syria, Hawaii Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard recently traveled to Syria with former Congressman Dennis Kucinich, and she reported that the Syrians say there is no difference between Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra, or ISIS. They're all the same. And in December of 2016, Tulsi Gabbard introduced a bill in Congress called the Stop Arming Terrorists Act, which is designed to prevent the U.S. government from providing direct assistance to terrorist groups or groups that directly or indirectly support the terrorists. The bill is H.R. 608. So please call your congressman and ask him or her to support H.R. 608, the Stop Arming Terrorists Act. And for more information about this bill, they have a website which is HR608.info. So HR608.info. And finally today, there's a group called Hands Off Syria Coalition, and their website is handsoffsyriacoalition.net. And this is what they are organizing. Quote, "We call on all peace-loving people throughout the world to unite and take action during the International Days of Action, March 11th through the 19th, against U.S. intervention in Syria and throughout the Middle East, against Islamophobia, and against the refugee travel ban." So if you want to learn more about these International Days of Action, you can go to their website, which is handsoffsyriacoalition.net, and you can get yourself on their mailing list there as well. And now some information about my shows. 9/11 Wake Up Call shows are archived at the website radioforall.net. And that's the digit four, so radioforall.net. And once on the site, click on Contributors in the right-hand column, and then you'll find the shows on the third page under the letter C for Cheryl. Click on my name, and the show should pop up in chronological order. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening. Power to the people. Power to the people. Power to the people. Power to the people. Right on.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
For years, International Women's Day has gone largely unnoticed or was depoliticized. Most people no longer know that its roots lie in the struggle of women garment workers in the United States, or that a mobilization of women in Russia to oppose World War I in 1917 was the spark for an uprising that led to the overthrow of the Tsar and set off the Russian Revolution. But this International Working Women's Day was decidedly different. Thousands showed up to rally, march, demonstrate at Day Without a Woman gatherings across New York City on March 8th, part of a nationwide one-day strike to show women's impact on the American economy. The strike was also a call to organize resistance, not just against Trump and his misogynist policies, but also against the conditions that produced Trump, namely the decades-long economic inequality, racial and sexual violence, and imperial policies abroad. Spotlights were shown on immigrant rights, and the call was loud and magnanimous to welcome those forced by the various necessities of human mobility to cross borders. Embraces were effusive for and enveloped the issues of LGBTQIA sisters and brothers, and similarly heartfelt support was extended to the mothers whose loved ones were murdered by police, and the protectors of indigenous lands and water rights received hearty cheers. This March 8th strike put radical politics at the center of the resistance. Rather than merely espousing shattering glass ceilings that impede women's ascent into career or electoral prominence, the strikers located the oppression of women in capitalism and the free market. Let's listen.
I'm a Yemeni-American community organizer. To my right is Wadad Hassan, who is also one of the organizers of the Bodega Strike. And right here is Huda Qureshi. She is a Yemeni-American businesswoman who shut her business today in solidarity to be here with us today. On February 2nd, less than a week after President Trump signed the executive order halting all immigration from seven predominantly Muslim countries, including Yemen, I, along with Wadad Hassan and Samar Nasser and other organizers, helped organize a Yemeni bodega strike to mobilize thousands of Yemeni bodega owners to shut down business in protest against Trump's illegal Muslim ban. These are businessmen that never really close shop, and they shut their businesses down for 8 hours. Following the great success of the bodega strike, thousands of Americans throughout the country took to the streets, and strikes were organized in other major cities and towns. A week later, the courts struck down that ban. Strikes work, boycotting works, protests work, and this is why I am here with you today. And like all immigrants, my family came to this country in pursuit of the American dream. Trump's ban has profoundly affected my family. Yemen has, in the past 2 years, there's been a full-out war, a war that is being waged by the Saudis and the unwavering assistance of the United States. Together, Saudi Arabia and the U.S. are pounding one of the poorest countries. This violence against my beloved homeland has internally displaced millions of Yemenis and has left thousands refugees throughout the world. Many of the displaced are women and children, some who have received visas through American spouses. My uncle, his wife, and their five children have had to live in Jordan since the beginning of the war. They had applied for resettlement in the United States and were approved until the first Muslim ban. On the night of Trump's signing, I called my uncle. He was in tears. I always believed that the United States was a country that welcomed immigrants. This is what he told me. This racist, bigoted ban has affected my more immediate family as well. My husband, Bashir Athman, is an independent Yemeni writer who served as a director of the Yemeni Institute for Social Studies. Bashir is a man who has sacrificed his own safety and security and who has dedicated his career to fighting extremist ideologies. In December of 2015, Yemen became increasingly dangerous for him. So he escaped the war, traveling to Goa, India. I petitioned for him to join me in the United States. His application went through a rigorous process of vetting. It lasted about a year. And it was approved, actually, November 18 of 2016, to finally be united. But then the bigoted ban was signed. I have a constitutional right as an American to have my husband here with me, just like any other American, and I demand it. That's it. Thank you. Thank you for your support. Thank you. Thank you.
Feminism for the masses, not just the ruling classes. Now it is my pleasure to introduce Black Lives Matter queer performer poet Jamara Michelle Wakefield.
Today is for the indigenous women. Today is for the black women. Today is for the Asian women and the Latina women. Today is for the Palestinian women and the Iranian women. For the descendants of slaves, for the colonized women, for the lesbian women. Today is for the queer women, for the bi women, for the trans women, for the poor women, for the fat women. Today is for the immigrants and the refugees and the migrant women. Today is for the girls who will become women, the victims of human trafficking women, the women who believe in gods that you do not know women. Today is for the developmentally delayed and the mentally ill women, for the incarcerated women and their families. Today is for the HIV positive women, for the women fighting cancer, for the women who live without health insurance. Today is for the infertile women who pray that their bodies will work women, for the homeless women menstruating in the streets. Today is for the low-wage women who can't take a day off from work. Today is for the women who don't eat because they don't have the money to eat. Today is for the women who clean your campuses who you refuse to see, for the adjunct professors who your campuses and your colleges refuse to pay. Today is for the women who are talked over in meetings, the women who are arrested for petty crimes. This is for the women who are drowning in debt and who feel ashamed about it. This is for the married women who still don't have enough help. This is for the sex worker women. And I want you to imagine not only a day without women, let's remind them that the whole world would fall apart without women. See, there is no reproduction without women. And really, to be honest with you, I could stop the poem right now, because if we no longer made our bodies available for procreation, the world would literally die. Jackie Joyner Hersey. I am black gold and running on you. We long jump heptathlon. We long jump heptathlon. We shot putt. We javelin throw. Thank you, Sister Jamara. One more time. Next up are wonderful people from the New York State Nurses Association, a union of 40,000 members. Please welcome Judy Shaidan Gonzalez. Do you feel the fire? While manufacturers make obscene profits, where droughts and disasters hit vulnerable populations as fossil fuel magnates make billions, caring little about these drastic climate changes, where water, air, and soil are contaminated by chemicals and pipelines, while corporations salivate over profits, ignoring the collateral damage, where whole sectors of society are marginalized, demonized, scapegoated, assaulted, deported, and murdered, and then blamed for the problems that exist in our world. Where people who work hard all their lives find their jobs disappear due to mergers, relocations, de-skilling, perversions of technology, aging out, and outsourcing, all in the name of the bottom line. This is the collateral damage of capitalism. Nurses every day see when uninsured patients put up a medical visit, only to find that they have advanced incurable disease. When the frail elderly have to choose between medications and food. When mental illness destroys families. And we know we're going to see a lot more of that if things continue. The repeal of the ACA, as weak as it is, will result in countless more health care tragedies. The loss of the safety net will destroy our public health system, and de-skilling of caregivers will only further the inequities we face. Finally, the unrelenting attacks against unions will deny access to many more people. And who bears the brunt of these attacks? Immigrant women, women of color, poor women, and our children statistically suffer the most. Women are already working two jobs, one inside the home and one outside the home. Our union supports a single-payer healthcare system, healthcare for all. We believe that quality healthcare is a human right. So factory speed up for nurses means we can't spend time with our patients. It robs us of the humanity of caring. But we refuse to accept this role of the hospital thing. Nurses and patients are human. What we offer is essential. We will light the fires of struggle, not destruction. Women can be the light of the future. We only need the courage to take the bold but necessary steps to build a better world. When women are under attack, what do we do? Stand up, fight back.
Before I introduce the next speaker, I just want to take a moment to remember a woman who we lost yesterday, a civil rights leader, lawyer, who gave her mind and soul and body to the people's struggle. Lynn Stewart. Presente.
Our next speaker is a biological trans woman, activist, Jew, and a member of RDSW, the Retail Wholesale Department Store Union, Octavia Leona Conner.
I am here on behalf of workers as a strike success story. The workers of Babeland voted to unionize. It was a long, long struggle. And you know what got the bosses to listen to us? It wasn't appealing to them as humans. It wasn't appealing to them as feminists. It wasn't appealing to them as women. It was appealing to their bottom dollar. When the bosses tried to bust us, when the bosses tried to keep our union from forming, they used their liberal identity politics, their statuses as women, as feminists, self-identified, to stop the union from forming. Yeah, right? It took us far too long to get any sort of contract negotiation going. They had a budget they would barely move on for three whole month. They were a small, woman-owned, feminist business. They couldn't afford to give us a single penny more. Over 80% of their workforce voted to strike. And the next week, we got a contract that was nearly triple the budget they said they would give us. Post-feminism is not my feminism. My feminism centers workers, women of color. My feminism centers trans women. My feminism centers sex workers, disabled women. Post-feminism is denial. It is self-interest over solidarity. The workers came together. We agitated, we educated, we organized, and when we did that, we got a coin. When we are united as workers, when we are united as an intersectional workforce, when the sex workers, when the trans woman, when the woman of color, when the disabled woman, when we center those most marginalized in our community, when we listen to them, when we put their voices forward, when our goal is to not only help them survive, but thrive. That is when our feminism is a success. I gotta say, I am tickled, like, not pink, I'm tickled red, that there are no Democrats on stage today. Thank Goddess for all the people out there who are fighting against this neocolonialist, imperialist, budding fascist regime that we have going on over here. Thank God I have a union! Like I said, center the most marginalized of us and strike! Strike against boss feminism! Strike against white feminism! Strike against cis feminism!
Feminism for the masses, not just for the ruling classes! Right! For the last several months, we know the fierce resistance has continued at Standing Rock. But here to talk is Betty Lyons, president of the American Indian Law Alliance and an indigenous and environmental activist.
Welcome to Haudenosaunee territory. I'm a proud citizen of the Onondaga Nation. The women's rights movement started with Haudenosaunee women. And we're going to be invisible no more. Where I come from, women choose our leadership. We set them up and we can take them down. And I'll tell you right now, that bastard sitting in the White House wouldn't be sitting there today if you guys had that privilege as well. The woman that I admire most is Mother Earth. She takes a lot of abuse, she's neglected, she's taken advantage of for her resources, and she's disrespected. And yet she still sends her love to us every single day. What's happening today against Mother Earth is in direct reflection of what's happening in our society. As we see the pipelines going forward, we need to stand up for the rights of Mother Earth. The most effective and compelling movements were movements born from women. We are amazing. I want to say one last thing. Don't diminish your light because somebody else can't stand it. It's too damn bad. Be powerful and know you're loved. Thank you.
I now am honored to introduce Lamis Deek, a Palestinian activist, attorney, and national coordinator.
Israel was thrust upon the Palestinian people in 1948, a racist settler colonialism that was cemented by the murder of over 50,000 Palestinians and the exile of 75% of the Palestinian population, while the rest was subject to a 69-year pattern of massacres and ethnic cleansing. But Zionist colonizers didn't just take Palestinian lands and factories. They took our homes and they slept in our beds. And it takes a particularly ugly ideology to kill a woman, sleep in her bed, and then claim that it is she who is the monster. And that ideology is called Zionism. Founded in the wealthy halls of Europe to inherit British colonialism by imposing an ethno-religious supremacist state in Palestine for 69 years, Zionist Israel has decimated Palestine and the entire Middle East. Since 1948, trillions of your tax dollars built for Zionist Israel, the fourth largest killing machine of the world, making Israel the colonial center and global exporter of oppression. And where there is oppression and dispossession, you will find Zionism and you will find Israel. In El Salvador's School of the Americas, in bed with Pinochet in Chile, supporting apartheid in South Africa, beating the war drum against Iran and Iraq, training the NYPD to spy, harass black and brown communities, funding Islamophobia, and building the wall in Mexico. In Palestine, thousands of Palestinian women have been kidnapped and raped inside Israeli dungeons. Inside the Green Line, Palestinian girls are lynched by European and American Zionist settlers who take selfies with their still warm dead bodies. In the West Bank, Palestinian women are sexually harassed by machine gun-toting Israelis, and they die giving birth at Israeli checkpoints. In Gaza, they are starved while their shores are drilled for gas. And we remain, still to this day, the largest refugee population in the world. So yes, but there is also resistance. And I come to tell you that our resistance is beautiful. Robbed of their lands, starved and robbed of their food and their water, dehumanized by international media and stateless, but still we are winning. Israel gave up the myth of victimhood and has joined the ranks of the global right and the Trump regime to wear its racism and violence as a badge of honor, while Palestine rises to the seat of global morality and human dignity. In Palestine, our women reproduce life from what men locked behind Israeli wars. And while Israel exports repression, Palestinians export freedom and liberation. Protests as strikes to the Arab world came from Palestine. Popular resistance tactics shared with the Black Lives Matter movement, the BDS movement, reawakened the worker strike and reignited campus activism. Palestinian freedom fighters fought the Contras in Nicaragua, and in Palestine, they fight for each other, practicing the ultimate self-sacrifice and love of each other, community, and the land. The Palestinian resistance is beautiful, and it is deserving of its Soweto moment when they are joined by all of you in the streets to celebrate their victory in shaking off the yokes of Zionist colonialism, when they can dismantle the Zionist ruling class, which threatens every one of you, every woman, everywhere. And so because their victory is your victory, we ask that you join us in the sacred chant of Long Live Palestine!
Long live Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
Well, thank you, Lamis.
No walls, no bans, no deportation. So Noor Abdullah with Sanctuary Campus Campaign.
I am a Palestinian American immigrant. I am also a United States citizen. Because of this, I have not been affected by the new regime's recent executive order. However, I do realize that this is not the case for everyone here and the people that I surround myself with on a daily basis. I am a sophomore at NYU, the member of NYU Sanctuary, and on behalf of Sanctuary Campus movements across the city. My statements today have been collectively authored by sanctuary organizers from NYU, the New School, Columbia University, and CUNY. We are a cross-campus group of sanctuary organizers putting pressure on our respective universities to declare themselves sanctuary campuses. Sanctuary in action means adopting a proactive response to violence by pledging to allocate financial, legal, institutional, and political means at our disposal to protect the most vulnerable members of our community. In a moment of profound uncertainty for so many, our universities must allocate their financial resources to aid threatened populations throughout New York City and support university constituents as they channel their knowledge and efforts towards citywide resistance against the Trump administration. I stand here ashamed and embarrassed that our university administrations cannot even commit themselves to systematically protecting their own student, faculty, and staff. NYU is my home, and my home is not a sanctuary. Sanctuary campus movements across the city come together today to make a clear statement to the Trump administration and to our university administrations that we will continue to prioritize and support the most vulnerable members of our communities and build our movement around their needs. We will continue to center around women of color, undocumented folks, queer and trans folks, Muslims, and immigrants. As a student-led movement in collaboration with faculty, staff, and other community members, we insist that other forms of political power are possible. We can help shift the balance of power at our schools in this country. We can hold those in power accountable and demand that they protect our interests over those of wealthy Board of Trustees members and other Trump-supporting stakeholders. Lastly, we can create infrastructure that are networks of support and rapid response, all of which those in power refuse to provide. We are committed to resisting the ignorance and the racism of this administration. And we are here to tell our university administration, this city, and this country that we refuse to be separated from one another. That we are not singular. That we will stand up when, and especially when, it is difficult. And that we will resist. We will not be silent. And we will not stand down. We are fighting back, and we will win. Thank you.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
The biggest enemy we must continue to fight continues to be our own government. How dare we stop? We cannot stop. We are not crumbs. We must not accept crumbs, and we must stop acting like crumbs.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. An Italian court christens two gay dads as legal parents, death threats don't deter a Trinidadian activist, and it's time to act up again. Those stories and more this week because you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Danny Cruz.
And I'm Jessica Andrea.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending March 4th, 2017. A court in northern Italy has broken new ground in the definition of family. The higher regional court of Trento ruled that both gay dads of twin boys born 6 years ago in Canada through a surrogate should be registered in Italy as the boys' legal parents. Surrogacy is against the law in Italy, so the man went to a country where it's legal. The unnamed couple were recognized as joint parents after a court fight in Canada, but when they brought those documents to Trento City Hall, they were told that only the biological father could be listed as the parent. The court ruled, however, that parental relationships are not defined solely by biology. On the contrary, the decision reads, one must consider the importance of parental responsibility, which is manifested in the conscious decision to raise and care for the child. Gabrielle Piazzoni of Italy's leading LGBTQ rights organization Arcigay noted, however, that while the ruling has some important cultural effects, it sets no legal precedent. He agreed with the court's belief, however, that we need to move the debate about parenting away from the biological approach that ignores the complexity and the wide plurality of families. Italy lags behind most other European nations that already have enacted full marriage equality. Same-gender couples were finally allowed to enter into less-than-equal civil unions late last year, but they're specifically barred from adopting children.
A Trinidad-born, UK-based queer rights advocate is getting death threats after he filed a legal challenge to the buggery laws of Trinidad and Tobago, the twin-island Caribbean nation off the northern coast of South America. Jason Jones is also challenging the Immigration Act of Trinidad and Tobago, which specifically denies entry to gays and lesbians. Even though the laws are rarely enforced, Jones argues that their mere existence contributes to a culture of homophobia. He told the Trinidad Daily Express that the police have dismissed several death threats that have been posted to his Facebook page as idle, not legitimate. But these are bold-faced death threats, Jones told the newspaper. They are saying I deserve a bullet through my head and I cannot do anything about it. Jones said that he moved out of a friend's house because I didn't want to put him at risk. He said that he's also hired a security firm. But Jones also expressed appreciation for the literally hundreds of people who have messaged me to find out how they can become involved. I am doing this for the betterment of our nation and for our future generations, he said. My resolve is even stronger now, so let them come, Jones added. I'm ready for them.
A number of major corporations have filed friend of the court briefs in support of Virginia High School student Gavin Grimm as anticipation grows for the first ever transgender-related case to be heard by the U.S. Supreme Court. The central issue, with oral arguments scheduled for March 28th, is whether or not federal civil rights laws that ban bias based on sex also protect transgender people. Apple, Spotify, IBM, Amazon, Intel, The Gap, PayPal, eBay, and Microsoft are among 53 of the biggest companies in the United States to sign on to the brief this week supporting Grimm's right to pee in the boys' bathroom. The companies say diversity and inclusion are central to their businesses, and recruiting trans people is a critical component of their missions. The cities of New York and San Francisco have also filed briefs supporting Grimm, along with unions representing more than a million teachers and other school personnel, and groups that include Americans United for Separation of Church and State and the Constitutional Accountability Center. Chase Strangio, a staff attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union, which is representing Grimm, told a March 2nd teleconference that he's hopeful that the High Court will issue a landmark ruling affirming transgender rights. But no matter what happens, he said, nobody is going back into the shadows. Nobody is going to stop fighting, and there will be many avenues for public and social change, as well as legal relief for the trans community.
There are Trump connections to a successful Free to Pee lawsuit in the U.S. state of Pennsylvania and to the Oscar-winning Moonlight. Juliette Ivanko, the transgender sister of Jackie Ivanko, who sang the national anthem at the Trump inauguration, was one of this week's three successful student plaintiffs demanding to use campus bathrooms consistent with their gender identity. The policy of Pennsylvania's Pine Richland School District currently requires transgender students to either use single-person bathrooms or facilities matching their birth gender. U.S. District Court Judge Mark R. Harnick cited the 14th Amendment's equal protection guarantees in ruling that the plaintiffs appear to the court to be young people seeking to do what young people try to do every day, go to school, obtain an education, and interact as equals with their peers. He said there was a reasonable likelihood that their lawsuit against the local school district would succeed and ordered that in the meantime, the students be allowed to use campus restrooms that match their gender identity.
And Franklin Graham, son of Billy and the leading preacher at Trump's inauguration, this week lamented Moonlight's Best Picture Oscar, saying it aims to induce young people into making homosexual lifestyle choices. Clearly demonstrating that he hasn't actually seen the film, Graham wrote that, from the reviews I read, Moonlight portrays a young, gay, African-American coming of age, and it stereotypes him as violent, a drug dealer, and a convict. Hollywood is notorious for glorifying sin, he said. I warn families and the church, don't allow your young people to be sucked into Hollywood's dark plan. The R-rated Oscar-winning film has been in limited release, and all of the eight other Best Picture nominees, including box office hits La La Land, Hidden Figures, and Arrival, continue to draw larger audiences. But Moonlight expands in the coming week to about 1,500 screens in the U.S. and Canada, its widest release yet. It remains to be seen, however, if Oscar boosts its box office numbers.
Meanwhile, TV and film star Patricia Arquette criticized the Academy this week for omitting her late transgender sister Alexis during the In Memoriam part of the Global Oscars telecast. Alexis Arquette died last September of complications from AIDS at the age of 47. She appeared in several films before transitioning, ranging from The Wedding Singer and Pulp Fiction, Two of Mice and Men, and Last Exit to Brooklyn. The Oscar-winning Patricia told Vanity Fair that her sister was a vanguard in the fight for understanding and acceptance for all trans people. At a time when we have trans kids that can't even go to the bathroom at school, she said, you would think the Academy would have a little bit more respect.
In other news, 17-year-old Mai King Johnson has become the first scholarship player on a major U.S. college football team to come out before he's even played his first game. The 6'4", 225-pound Tempe High School defensive end has committed to being a Wildcat at his home state, University of Arizona. He came out to his supportive mother, Nadette Lewis, when he was 12 years old. According to a story in the Arizona Daily Star newspaper, she told him that it doesn't matter. Love who you are, no matter what you are. If you love yourself first, then everybody else will respect that and have no choice but to love you. When Johnson came out to him at a recruitment meeting, University of Arizona defensive line coach Vince Amay said simply that, we want you to be a Wildcat. I do feel like this can put a target on my back, Johnson said. He later tweeted, I'm just here to play football.
And finally, a female-to-male transgender high school wrestler in Texas who's been forced to compete as a girl handily won the state's girls' championship this week in the 110-pound weight classification. Mac Beggs, a 17-year-old junior at Trinity High School in Euless, began transitioning 2 years ago. The University Interscholastic League, which oversees sports in Texas public schools, ordered Beggs to continue competing in the girls' division despite his obvious physical advantage. He's been getting testosterone injections during his transition process. Dallas sportscaster Dale Hansen was one of the few in his profession to speak out in support of Michael Sam when the University of Missouri standout became the first openly gay professional football player in the U.S. And he still gets it, telling his WFAA TV viewers this week that
Mac Beggs does not need a group of old men in Austin telling him who to wrestle because of a genetic mix-up at birth. We have argued long enough about birth certificates. It's an argument that needs to end. You don't have to understand. I don't understand. But Mac Beggs is a child simply looking for his place in the world and a chance to compete in the world. Do we really not have the simple decency to allow him at least that?
Dallas sportscaster Dale Hansen.
That's News Wrap for the week ending March 4th, 2017. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Jessica Andrea.
And I'm Danny Cruz.
I'm Greg Gordon with the News Wrap update. There won't be oral arguments as scheduled on March 28th at the U.S. Supreme Court in the case of transgender Virginia teen Gavin Grimm. A terse order issued by the High Court on March 6th sent the case back to the 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Richmond, Virginia, for further consideration. That court ruled in Grimm's favor last year. The order cited the Trump administration's rollback of Obama-era protections for transgender students as the reason for the delay. The case may now not be heard for months, if not years, and both sides have expressed disappointment that the issue won't be more immediately resolved. We'll have more on this developing story next time on This Way Out.
When the 20th anniversary of the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power rolled around, it was not a time for soggy reminiscences and gold watches for work well done. Still neck deep in the George W. Bush administration, in March of 2007, U.S. activists were fighting Don't Ask, Don't Tell, while Joint Chiefs of Staff Chair General Peter Pace had no qualms about calling homosexual behavior immoral. The Defense of Marriage Act was also the law of the land. A slew of state-level anti-LGBTQ measures were rallying conservative religious voters to the polls, and it was a year before any audacious hope and change could be seen on the horizon. We seem to have come full circle a decade later, with a list of astonishing victories now threatened as the pendulum swings from the era of Obama to the turbulence of Trump. So it's more than timely to mark the 30th anniversary of ACT UP by reconsidering what the group's founder had to say at the commemoration 10 years ago. Here's Greg Gordon.
Larry Kramer, the firebrand instigator of the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, marked ACT UP's 20th anniversary with a new demand for action. It was March 13th at New York City's LGBT Center, and Kramer was primed for a fight. In an almost hour-long speech, the author of the novel Faggots, the play The Normal Heart, and the screenplay for Women in Love recounted the many accomplishments of ACT UP and detailed the ongoing persecution against lesbian, gay, bi, and trans people in the U.S. and around the world. What follows is some of what he had to say.
Freedom! We're talking about your freedom! Freedom to choose what to do with your body. Freedom to believe what you like. Freedom for brothers to love one another. Freedom for black and white. Freedom from elitism, male domination. Freedom for the mother and wife. Freedom from big brother's interrogation. Freedom to live your
AIDS came along. It happened fast. Almost every man I was friendly with died. Many of us will always have memories like this that we can never escape. Out of this came ACT UP. We grew to have chapters and affinity groups and spin-offs and affiliations all over the world. Hundreds of men and women once met weekly in New York City alone. Every single treatment against HIV is out there because of activists who forced these drugs out of the system, out of the labs, out of the pharmaceutical companies, out of the government, into the world. It is an achievement unlike any other in the history of the world. All gay men and women must let ourselves feel colossally proud of such an achievement. Hundreds of millions of people will be healthier because of us. Would that they would or could be grateful to us for saving their lives. We had regular demonstrations, die-ins we call them, at the Food and Drug Administration, in the National Institutes of Health, at city halls, at the White House, in the halls of Congress, at government buildings everywhere, starting with our first demonstration on Wall Street, where crowds of us lay flat on the ground with our arms crossed over our chest or holding cardboard tombstones until the cops had to cart us away by the vans full. A lot of us got arrested a lot of times. A lot of us. We kept our lawyers' members busy. It actually was a wonderful feeling being locked up behind bars and cells with the brothers and sisters you have fought with side by side for what you fervently believe in. Slowly we were noticed, and even more slowly, we were listened to. How could a population of gay people call us the survivors or the descendants of those who did all this, be so relatively useless now? Maybe useless is too harsh. Ineffectual. Invisible. No, useless is not too harsh. Oh, let us just call ourselves underutilized. The old ACT UP is no longer useful enough. There are not enough of us. Few people go to meetings. Our chapters have evaporated. Our voice has dimmed in its volume and its luster. Our protests are no longer heard. We must be heard. We must be. We are not crumbs. We should not accept crumbs. We must not accept crumbs. They don't want us here. When are we going to face up to this? We are discriminated against at every turn. Gays are equal to nothing good or acceptable in this country. It is criminal how they treat us. We get further and further from progress and equality with each passing year. This is not just about gay marriage. Political candidates only talk about gay marriage, making nicey-nice maybes. And we are not demanding that they talk about the kind of equality I am talking about. Gay marriage has become a useful red herring for them to pretend they are talking about gays when they are not. For some reason, our movement has confined its feeble demands to marriage. Well, my lover and I don't want to get married just yet. But we sure want to be equal. I wish I could make all gay people everywhere accept this one fact that I know to be an undisputed truth. We are hated. Haven't enough of us died for all of us to believe this? 70 million cases of HIV were all brewed in a cauldron of hate. This is not meant as finger-pointing or blame. It just is.
Hi, I'm Cleve Jones, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. An informed community is a strong community.
You're listening to excerpts from a speech by pioneering AIDS activist and author Larry Kramer, given on the occasion of the 20th anniversary of ACT UP, the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power. Kramer's analysis of the progress toward LGBT equality, the failures of the queer rights movement, and his hopes for the future continues.
I also know that any organization that we start now must be an army. You have resisted this word in the past. Perhaps now that the man in charge of America's army is calling you immoral, you won't resist being called an army anymore. We must field an organized army with elected leaders and a chain of command. It must be a gay army with gay leaders fighting for gay people under a gay flag in gay battle formations against our common enemies, uncontaminated by any fear of offending or by any sense that this might not be the time to say what we really need to say. We must cease our never-ending docile cooperation with a status quo that never changes in its relationship to us. It is very wearying to witness our carrying on so passively, year after year, particularly now that all of us, and I mean all of us have been given the gift of life. I know that young gays don't think this way, but many of us died to give you this gift of staying alive. You are alive because of us. I wish you would see this. And we all owe it to the dead as well as to ourselves to continue a fight that we have stopped fighting. We do not seem to realize that the more we become visible, that more and more of us come out of the closet, the more vulnerable we become to the more and more increasingly visible hate against us. In other words, the more they see us, the more they hate us. The more new gays they see, the more new ways they find to hate us. We do not seem to realize that the more we urge each other to come out, which indeed we must never stop doing, the more we must protect ourselves for and from our exits onto the stage of the world that hates us more and more. It has been a painful lesson to learn, but democracy does not protect us. Unity does. United commitment to confront our many foes. I am not asking you if you even want another organization. I am just hoping that you are smart enough to realize, Eureka, that the good deeds we once accomplished, which changed history, can be accomplished again. For we are still facing the same danger, our extermination, and from the same enemy, our own country, our own country's democratic process. Day after day, our country declares that we are not equal to anything at all. All the lives we saved are nothing but crumbs if we still aren't free. And gay people still aren't free. Think about it. Think about all of this, please. We are the only people in America that it is socially acceptable to hate and discriminate against. Indeed, so much hate of us exists that it is legally acceptable to pass constitutional amendments to hate us even more. This is democracy. This is how our courts and laws protect us. These are the equal rights for all that America's Bill of Rights proclaim for all. The biggest enemy we must continue to fight continues to be our own government. How dare we stop? We cannot stop. We are not crumbs. We must not accept crumbs, and we must stop acting like crumbs. ACT UP is the most successful grassroots organization that ever lived, period. There never was, never has been, one more successful that has achieved as much as we. We did it before. We can do it again. But to be successful, activism must be practiced every day by a lot of people. It made us proud once. It united us. With a renewed commitment to love and support and to fight to save each other, with a renewed commitment to the anger that saved us once before, with the belief that anger, along with love, are the two most healthy and powerful emotions we are good at. I believe that we could have such a historical success again. May I conclude these thoughts, these remarks, toward the definition of a new ACT UP that will hopefully begin to be discussed forthwith with this cry from my heart. Farewell, ACT UP. Long live ACT UP. Thank you.
That was author activist Larry Kramer commemorating the 20th anniversary of the founding of ACT UP, the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power. 2 days later, 250 protesters joined him at Times Square's Army Recruiting Center to denounce General Peter Pace's characterization of gays and lesbians as immoral. More ACT UP-style demonstrations are planned for San Francisco and New York. And after that...
Prejudice, poison, pollution this land.
Maybe useless is too harsh, ineffectual, invisible. No, useless is not too harsh.
In the final analysis, it's the point to chafe the status quo so that things change. And if the immediate community gets rubbed the wrong way too, that's simply part of how history moves.
Larry Kramer's ACT UP anniversary speech rubbed a lot of people the wrong way in 2007. Queer historian Stuart Timmons shared his assessment of the controversy then, and we'll share his thoughts again with you next time on This Way Out. Thanks for discovering This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Danny Cruz and Jessica Andrea contributed program material, with thanks as always to Steve Pride. The Tom Robinson Band performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors, for making this program possible. It's always a good time to log on to thiswayout.org and join the family. Check us out on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078 USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org. And on 7LTN Launceston, Tasmania, WAZU Peoria, Illinois, CKDU Halifax, Nova Scotia, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now y'all stay tuned.
Thank you. You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Alan Watts was deeply interested in and engaged with Eastern thought and philosophy. He was a philosopher, a sought-after lecturer, and the author of more than 24 books. Alan Watts was, most prominently, an influential interpreter of Eastern philosophy, comparing it to, and to some degree, integrating it into, emerging Western modes of thought and understanding. Watts's message was spread by, among other outlets, KPFA, on which Alan Watts hosted a radio program for 24, beginning in 1953. That seems a long time ago, and yet there's something both deep and timeless about Watts's thoughts and words. And today we're pleased to present portions of two talks by Alan Watts that are part of the Alan Watts Library Collection, compiled by the Pacifica Radio Archives, and comprising 28 hours of audio of broadcasts and seminars and talks that Alan Watts gave over the course of 20 years. 28 hours of Alan Watts on three MP3 CDs are yours as a thank you gift for a one-year, $180 pledge to this listener-supported radio station. And you can split that into six equal monthly installments, so that would be $30 a month over 6 months would be your pledge, and you do not have to pay all of your installments to get the magisterial Alan Watts Library Collection 28 hours of audio. Talk to the phone room, and the phone number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732, easily remembered as 1-800-HEY-KPFA, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Let's turn now to one of the selections on this Alan Watts super pack. It's called Reconciliation of Opposites.
It's always interesting to me to see how often
psychologists and psychotherapists talk about the problem of reconciling opposites. Anybody who knows anything at all about the elementary principles, say, of psychoanalysis, knows that according to the ideas of both Freud and Jung, that according to their ideas, there is a kind of compensatory relationship between what is conscious and what is unconscious in our mental life. And that to the degree that one is, as it were, light above, one is dark below, or to the degree that one is dark above, one is light below. And it's often pointed out that very many people who wrote the most scurrilous books, such as Rabelais, led the most exemplary lives. Whereas, on the other hand, a lot of people who wrote very pious and holy books actually led disreputable lives. And I think there is a great deal of truth in the way Freud so often points out that what is expressed in the world of dreams is the opposite side of life to that which one is living consciously. And that, therefore, the problem of integrating a person, of making him whole, and it's interesting, isn't it, that the word whole is etymologically related to the word holy, but the problem of making a person whole is to get together his two apparently opposed sides. And underneath all this, there is the recognition that so many things which seem at one level to be opposed to each other are at another level mutually necessary. And this is something that's terribly difficult for us to admit. We don't like to uncover the basic harmony which very often underlies things that we would rather prefer to see in opposition to each other. Take, for example, the fundamental opposition of life and death. Isn't it perfectly extraordinary the way we manage to conceal, or most people manage to conceal, the fact that they keep alive by death, day in and day out? After all, we are constantly transforming dead animals and plants into the shape of our own organisms. But all this kind of thing, you know, is conveniently put away. The slaughterhouse is somewhere in a back district of Chicago, and we just don't get to see what goes on. And, of course, we conceal death in so many ways. The whole art of the mortician, as he likes to style himself, is to conceal death. And therefore, because death is constantly repressed, we begin to forget how much life and death go together. And so, if to the degree that we fail to recognize the inseparability of things that we call opposites, to that degree, we keep running into problems that baffle us and that we don't understand. We don't understand, for example, how necessary our enemies are to us. How the things that we fight against are things which stimulate us and call out our energies. And while, in other words, it seems to be necessary to muster all our strength to oppose certain things, if we should overdo it and muster too much strength and succeed in getting rid of our enemies, we might very well collapse. And so something of this kind underlies The very, very usual idea in Eastern philosophy of the truth lying in the middle, in other words, in Confucianism. One of the cardinal principles of Confucianism is the so-called doctrine of the mean. And interpreted at one level, this is rather just a platitudinous doctrine of moderation, that one should be moderate in all things. And in the same way, Buddhism is called the middle way. And that too, at a certain low level of interpretation, means nothing more than that this is a doctrine of moderation. But that is only part of the point, because what the middle way really comes to is not moderation, it isn't compromise, but really a profound understanding of the unity that underlies all oppositions. You know, so often we think logically that life consists fundamentally in oppositions, that, as it were, conflict is the most fundamental reality that there is. We look upon life, in other words, as an encounter. This happens in all sorts of different ways. The encounter of spirit and matter, the encounter of mind and body, and also the encounter of oneself and the world. As if these things came from unimaginable distances apart and suddenly met each other, and by reason of being, as it were, logically opposed to each other, there is thereupon conflict. But obviously, there can't be a battle unless there's a battlefield. It's often said it's very difficult to arrange a battle between a tiger and a shark because they have no common field. Wherever there is a battle, preceding the conflict, prior to it, underlying it, is something in common. As the very fact that two people who are having a fight have something in common, that there's something they both want to get, and so are fighting over it. What they want to get, they have in common. And because they have the same desire, they are the same kind of creature, they have that life in common. And so underlying every contest, there is a fundamental agreement, as in Alice, Tweedledum and Tweedledee agreed to have a battle. So the real meaning of the middle way, and Buddhism is often simply called the middle way, is to go down underneath conflict to discover harmony.
That's Alan Watts. Alan Watts was a philosopher, a lecturer, an author, influential interpreter of Eastern thought and philosophy, scholar of comparative philosophy and psychology. For a number of years, he taught comparative philosophy and psychology, held a master's degree in theology, wrote more than 25 books. His books have been translated into at least 11 languages. I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on listener-supported KPFA. And we're going to go back to more of Alan Watts. You've been listening to portions of a talk he gave called Reconciliation of Opposites. And it is part of a 28-hour Alan Watts library collection. And it contains 28 hours of Alan Watts giving talks and presentations. And it comes your way on three MP3 CDs. And it's called the Alan Watts Library Collection, and it's yours for a pledge of $180 or more to KPFA and to Against the Grain. And actually, this is the last day, this fund drive, that Sasha and I will be coming your way asking for your support specifically for Against the Grain. You know that we air Mondays through Wednesdays from noon to 1. So this is our last Wednesday of this fund drive, and this fund drive ends this week. It ends on Saturday. So if you appreciate this program and you want this, a very high value thank you gift that will give you hours and hours of insights and reflections and a knowledge and all kinds of insights into human nature and relationships and environmental processes and Eastern philosophy, Western worldview, the pursuit of happiness, the meaning of life. These are all big questions that Alan Watts presented and tried to answer. 1-800-439-5732 is the phone number. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-KPFA or 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You can also pledge securely online at kpfa.org. It's a quick call. It's an easy call. And it means that you are help powering our effort to get to our goal of $610,000 by Saturday. And we are now at about $460,000, which if you think about it, means a lot of people giving out of the goodness of their hearts. And also, in many cases, because they would like a thank you gift in addition to KPFA's programming. They wanted a thank you gift, and this is as good as we can give you, the 28-hour Alan Watts Library Collection. 1-800-439-5732. I want to go now to another selection from this Alan Watts Library Collection, and this particular talk is called Parallel Thoughts East and West. Let's have a listen.
I've drawn attention to a curious distinction between Chinese and typically Western attitudes to human nature. We are reared in the West with a rather fundamental mistrust of our own nature. To use a Platonic analogy, we think of man as a sort of rider on a horse, a two-natured person who has a rational soul and an animal body. And the animal body is regarded as something vital but stupid, in charge of the rational soul, whose origins seem to be completely independent of those of the animal body. And so the whole problem and the task of human life is to subjugate the animal body to the rational will. Now, therefore, it is somewhat alien to the West and to Western traditions of thought to see any sanity in putting trust in the wisdom of one's own animal nature. Now, of course, there were tendencies in this direction that arose in the 18th century and strengthened in the 19th century in what we call philosophy of nature and later the Romantic movement in literature. These, say, were associated with the work of Rousseau, for example, with his philosophy of the noble savage, the idea that man was by nature free, and as a result of the superimpositions of artificial social structures, has been found everywhere in chains. We are, I think, beginning to come to a point of view whereby we must recognize that although human nature is not something which, if, as it were not interfered with, would be entirely good, which is, I think, roughly the Romantic point of view, but rather to say something like this: the human nature, as we find it, is an interplay, a balance of good and evil, of positive and negative, and that sanity consists in respecting this balance. See, this is not a sentimental point of view. It does not ignore the fact, for example, that we live by destroying other organisms, that there is inevitable conflict in life in its natural state, but that this conflict is something which subserves a higher kind of harmony, and therefore has to be trusted, or rather has to be supported, accepted, and contained. and that sanity consists fundamentally in this. Now then, on the basis of this sort of attitude to human nature, there has been developed a kind of movement in the West, you could hardly call it a movement in any organized sense, which seems to have originated in Germany. Some years ago in Germany, there was a woman called Elsa Gindler, and she happened to have a serious case of tuberculosis. Her doctors told her, at that time, many years ago, she died at the age of 70, about 2 or 3 years ago, that she was a hopeless case. There was nothing further they could do for her, and that she may as well get ready for the end. She therefore betook herself, I think, to the Black Forest, and found herself a quiet little hut where she could live in the forest alone. And she said, if this disease came by itself, it can go by itself. And she decided to make an experiment that she would become as vividly aware as she could of all the subtle motions that were going on inside her body, all the subtle little feelings that she had, and she would respond to them. And so, in the quiet of the forest, she became silent and very, very responsive to everything that was going on within her, in the kind of inner life of her organism. And by doing this, after about a year had passed, she found herself recovered from the disease. And this so fascinated her that she explored further the promptings of her own nature and explored ways of teaching it to other people and eventually developed a kind of system of instructing others in this art. But nobody was ever able to think up a kind of label or name for what this art is. Of course, the Chinese would say this is the art of Taoism. This is the art that is called in Chinese Wu Wei, or non-interference with the Tao, that is to say, with the course of nature. But you see, in describing the way that Elsa Gindler went about this, you can see at once that non-interference is a highly difficult thing requiring a great deal of intelligence. So you have to be patient, you have to be intelligent, you have to be sensitive in order to respond to these subtle promptings of the organism itself. It's a fascinating experiment in simply becoming ever more aware of one's physical organism and learning to trust it and learning to become in accord consciously with what it wants to do, and that wish or that want is ordinarily unconscious. And therefore, it's something that's very difficult to explain without actually participating in it, without doing it. Perhaps I might introduce this by a story which Charlotte Selver once told me about herself and her study with Elsa Gindler. One of the things that Elsa Gindler tried sometimes to get her students to do was to make a drawing of the way in which one feels one's own body. And when Charlotte first went to study with her, she was full of all kinds of funny ideas, and when she was asked to draw how she feels, she made a grand drawing of everything about herself that she knew intellectually, you see, that she had. All her bones and muscles and everything were put there in the right position. There were several people in the class, and when all the drawings were put up along the wall, Charlotte Selver was astonished to see that none of the other drawings looked in the least bit like her own. They were all kinds of funny lines and blotches and blobs, and indeed one of them was simply a blank piece of paper with a small black spot on it. And she said that Elsa Gindler walked along the drawings, making various comments about them. And when she came to the one with the black spot, she said, "Oh, I see you still have that tension in your left hip." And Charlotte was expecting, you see, that at the time that Elsa Gindler arrived at her, she would compliment her on what a really sensitive drawing she had done of her own body. But when she finally approached that drawing, she said nothing and passed right on. And that was a great moment. That was one of those moments of truth in life, those moments of conversion, when one finds out the difference between what you think you feel and what you really feel. One of the things most strongly emphasized in this work is that we're all brought up to try and conform ourselves to fixed patterns of what a human being ought to be. This happens in very many different ways, but one of the ways in which it happens is how we ought to move and hold ourselves physically. We talk about postures. What is the right way to sit, the right way to stand, the right way to use one's hands, and so on and so forth. And of course, it doesn't strike us that all these things are very stylized. And if they don't correspond in any way with what our physical organism actually wants to do, the adoption of these stylized postures is going to cause conflict between what we try to be and what we are. And since what we try to be has really no special virtue about it, a lot of the postures that we adopt have no particular sense to them at all. They're sort of social rituals. I want to quote from Charlotte Selver's article in the General Semantics Bulletin, a little story. She says, "The other day I visited some friends. Among the guests there was a couple with their daughter, a little girl of 8, a thoughtful and very graceful child. While we were talking, the little girl played in the garden. I had the pleasure of watching her through the window. Then she came upstairs and sat down, one leg hanging down, the other one on the couch. Mother said, 'But Helen, how do you sit? Take your leg off the couch. A girl never should sit like that.' The little girl took her leg down, on which occasion her skirt flew high above her knees. The mother: 'Helen, pull your skirt down. One can see everything.' The child blushed, looked down on herself and pulled her skirt down, but asked, 'Why? What is wrong?' The mother looked at her quite shocked and said, 'One doesn't do that.' By this time, the atmosphere in the room was completely uncomfortable. The little girl not only had her legs down, but had them pressed against each other. Her shoulders had gone up, and she held her arms tight against her little body. This went on until she couldn't stand it any longer. She suddenly stretched herself and yawned heartily. Again, a storm of indignation from her mother. By now, this all lasted about 10 minutes, the child had changed completely. Her gracefulness had turned into awkwardness. All her motions were stilled. Her little body was tense. She hardly seemed to be alive anymore. What will happen to this child? She will hold her unhappy pose for a few minutes before she shakes it off. The next time, her mother will admonish her. She will hold it a few minutes longer, and so on, each time a little longer, until at last she will have repressed her naturalness so deeply that she will have forgotten it. The mother will then have reached her goal. She will have educated her to be socially acceptable. As a human being, the child will be greatly inhibited, because as the mother will chain her in this direction, she will chain her in 1,000 other directions." End of quote. And so you see, it isn't simply in the social conditioning of the child. It's not simply a matter of training children in the fundamental conventions of moral behavior, which perhaps are artificial, but certainly are necessary for some sort of social cohesion and agreement. But the training of children in all kinds of weird symbolic attitudes, which are held to be proper and nice and ritualistically decent, which produces in all of us a state of chronic psychophysical strain and discomfort, which after a while becomes unconscious. We fail to notice it, but it underlies our ulcers and our irritations and our frustrations, which eventually build up into our vast and appalling political idiocies.
Alan Watts, philosopher, author, influential interpreter of Eastern thought, and legendary KPFA broadcaster. He hosted a KPFA radio program for 20 years, beginning in 1953. I'm C.S. Song. This is Against the Grain on listener-sponsored KPFA. And Sasha will join me in a moment. Sasha, we are coming to you on the last day of Against the Grain during this KPFA fund drive, and we are hoping you will come out and support this program and support KPFA and pick up for yourself this amazing thank you gift. It's not a couple hours of Alan Watts. It's not 5 hours. It's not 15 hours. It's not 22. It's 28 hours of Alan Watts talking to you about Buddhism, but really actually going far beyond that, because he knows a lot of Eastern thought and philosophy in addition to and beyond Buddhism. You heard him talk about Taoism and the Tao, which also fascinates me personally. So we are offering this 28-hour Alan Watts library collection, 3 MP3 CDs for $180 one-year pledge to KPFA. And we're going to return to more of this talk called Parallel Thoughts East and West, which is part of this Alan Watts library collection. But I am now ready to give our first match of the hour. This is our first challenge of the hour. We've been given two this hour since, again, it is our last hour, asking you for your support. And it is in the amount of $600. It comes from Shiva in Campbell, California. I have a good friend in Campbell. Shiva in Campbell and Afsane in San Jose. So I want to thank Shiva and Afsane. And they have put together $600, and they want to challenge you. They are challenging you right now in the next 3 minutes to double their money and double the money that goes to KPFA. So they'll match you dollar for dollar, which means a $180 pledge to KPFA gets you not just the Alan Watts Library Collection, all 28 hours of this amazing scholar and writer and lecturer and broadcaster, but also we get $360 because your dollars are doubled by Shiva and Afsane. So give us a call, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. And it's easily remembered as either 1-800-439-KPFA or 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Toll free. Give us a call, and I bet you're going to feel really good after you spend just a couple minutes on the phone line with our phone room folks, because you will have given us something that perhaps you believe in very deeply and that you care about very deeply. The act of giving, as Alan Watts would tell anyone, it's a wonderful thing. It's a truly enriching thing for not just the givee, not just the person to whom a gift is given, but the giver. I love to give things to people personally. It's a universal human quality. And then you'll know the Alan Watts Library Collection will be coming your way. All 28 hours of Alan Watts. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. We've got about a minute and a half left to make this match of $600. And we can do it if people come forward, and especially people who are interested in the big issues, the nature of reality, how our minds work, comparative emphases of Eastern and Western philosophies, the interconnectedness of things. You can tell that Alan Watts was a wonderful storyteller. Joseph Campbell, the great scholar of mythology and religion and philosophy, Joseph Campbell praised Alan Watts' efforts to convey the history and the development of Eastern thought. Give us a call, 1-800-439-5732. Tell Sasha and I that we're doing the right thing. We're giving you the kinds of information you want. We're giving you the deep level analysis and commentary that you want, and you will get this wonderful thank you gift that may be more, you know, worth a lot more than what you are giving. And remember, your contribution is tax deductible, so you're not even really giving us $180. 1-800-439-5732. Nagging cough by yours on the part of yours truly, but soldiering ahead. 1-800-439-5732. When I come back to you, I'll let you know whether we made that match, but in keeping with my promise, I want to return to more of a talk given by Alan Watts called Parallel Thoughts East and West. Here's Alan Watts.
It's very difficult to get people to recover from this. Because, you see, in trying to come back to themselves, to come back to a unity and harmony with their own organisms, they still have the cast of mind, the tendency to look to authority of some kind to tell them what they ought to be. And Charlotte Selver has often told me that people who come to work with her expect to be told what kind of physical posture, what kind of physical feelings they ought to have. She says they want to know how to move, how to stand, how to sit, or in order to be exercised, they're quite astonished at first when they're invited to become more restful, to give up the doing so that they can listen better to what their body has to tell them. We need quiet for self-experience, quiet and awakeness. We need permissiveness, too, to all the subtle changes which may be needed. We ask, therefore, what can one feel of one's own organism? What of happenings within? Not what one knows of one's body, or what one thinks about it, or believes somebody else expects one to feel of it, but what one actually senses, no matter what comes to the fore. But this is difficult, of course, because we expect that we are supposed to conform to a pattern, and that there is somebody who knows what we ideally ought to be, ought to feel. And this despite, this is the curious thing, this is the paradox, this despite all the emphasis in the Western world on the value of individuality, the value of personal uniquenesses and the differences between man and man. Isn't it strange that to fulfill this great ideal, this democratic, personalistic ideal of the Western world, it seems to be very necessary for us to learn from the East and from things like the East, to learn from the very great differences which exist between one individual physical organism and another, to trust what Charlotte Selver and Elsa Gindler used to call one's own inner. This is, I suppose, the most difficult thing to explain in words, because when we just think about it theoretically, all kinds of objections come up to it. And we think that there can only be sanity, only order in society by holding a club over ourselves as if we were naturally, organically, and physically little monsters. Really, there is no monstrousness in nature like the monstrousness of man. We talk about the violent life of the ocean's depths, of the way the fishes eat each other and live in perpetual conflict. At least the fishes stay in the ocean and don't come up and attack the birds and the mammals and the people on the dry land. But nobody is safe from man. Radioactive fish in the Pacific. Birds bewildered by turmoil in the skies. Insects ravaged and upset in their balances. This is not a condemnation of human intelligence, but an appeal to human intelligence to be both intelligent and sensitive, to be temporarily at least silent before the subtle movements of nature, to study them better, and to work with the grain of the world instead of against it.
Alan Watts, I'm always caught up by that last comment. So he doesn't want to work against the grain. Well, you know, actually that makes sense in that context, but I resent him for saying it during our hour. But wait a second, I actually chose to have him say this during this hour, and I'm delighted by the vast majority of what he says, because I learn a lot from Alan Watts, and you can learn a ton from 28 hours of Alan Watts on three MP3 CDs for just a $180 pledge to KPFA. Now, think about it. Sometimes a talk for an hour will offer as a thank you gift for a $75 pledge. You get 28 hours of Alan Watts for a $180 pledge, which you can break down into six monthly installments of $30 per month. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. It's the magic phone number. And with only 15 minutes left to be with you before this, the last Against the Grain of this fund drive ends, Sasha and I feel a particular urgency toward raising money for KPFA, helping this station, helping this radio program, this specific radio program, survive and possibly thrive. Although you can imagine in these days of radio broadcasting and community radio broadcasting, that is a more and more difficult challenge. By the way, you know, we got to be honest about these things. We actually did not make that match of $600. So we did not get that money, as far as I know, from Shiva and Campbell and Afsani and in San Jose, although we did get pledges from John White and Lyons, I'm not sure if that's California, and from Lloyd Iverson in Santa Rosa, and from Lais Pallison in Menlo Park. You know, actually, women have come pretty close to making that match. And Connie Sanchez from Novato has pledged. And so it makes it especially important, Sasha, who is alongside now, that we make this final very large challenge put up by five listeners. So this is a collective effort by five listeners, and they are challenging you to collectively come up with $1,000. So they will match you dollar for dollar. They will double your money, but only if we can come up with $1,000 from all of you out there. Dana in Fairfax, Jasmine or Hasmin in San Francisco, Benjamin in Berkeley, James in Concord, Alil in San Leandro. These people have put up a combined $1,000 match. And so this is your chance to really get in and get a lot of Alan Watts talking about philosophy and about Buddhism and about meaning and about beauty and about conformity and about nonconformity, about opposites, about where the truth lies, at least in terms of Eastern thought, about what we do to our children, about what happened to us as children, about the opposition between our rational side and our, quote, animal nature instincts, about the chronic psychophysical strain and discomfort we are under, about efforts to socialize us and to make us conform in certain ways and to ignore many aspects of ourselves and our existence, some of which are essential to our well-being and peace of mind, 28 hours of Alan Watts, and it is yours for a $180 pledge to KPFA. 1-800-439-5732. And before I turn it over to Sasha, I just want to tell you the titles of some of this, of these talks on this Alan Watts 28-hour library collection. The Art of Psychoanalysis. There are three parts to that. That's interesting. Conscience and Concentration. The Spiritual Odyssey of Aldous Huxley. Fundamentals of Eastern Philosophy. Fundamentals of Buddhism. Discussion of Buddhist Mysticism. The Bhagavad Gita. Paul Tillich on the Eternal Now. The Study of Asia. The Constitution of Nature. The Tea Ceremony. Philosophy as Music. There's a tribute to C.G. Jung here. I mean, he was really a wide-ranging thinker. There's a memorial tribute to Alan Watts in this thing. And this is a few of the titles in this 28-hour Alan Watts Library Collection. We've got 11 minutes to make this match. Every dollar you give is so important, whatever you can give. And there are thank you gifts of all kinds. If you go to kpfa.org, you can pledge whatever you like, and you can choose a thank you gift among all the thank you gifts that have been offered on this program, this fund drive, and on any program thus far, this fund drive. Do a little, quote, shopping there if you like, but hopefully you want to give because you care about the station and you want it to continue. 1-800-439-5732. Again, $180 or $30 a month over 6 months gets you this Alan Watts Library Collection.
1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You can also pledge online at kpfa.org. And as C.S. said, this is the last day in this fund drive that C.S. and I will come to you and ask you for funds for KPFA and for Against the Grain. And we really are hoping to go out with a flurry of support. And this match of $1,000 is a wonderful way to make your money go further right now if you pledge at 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or kpfa.org. We're so grateful to these five listeners for banding together and putting up $1,000. We so have to make this match. As C.S. said, we came close, but we did not make the last match, and this is the final day for us. So please, there's a lot at stake for us right now, a lot at stake for the station, and I would hence say a lot at stake for you in terms of having this station be as vibrant as it can be and this program be as vibrant as it can be. So please, won't you support us right now? You can get the six CD Alan Watts collection for $180 pledge of support. You could also, if you feel so inclined, one very popular thank you gift during this fund drive has been Voices That Change the World, this collection from the Pacifica Radio Archives. If you go to kpfa.org and click on the donate link, you will find lots of compelling, wonderful thank you gifts. But let me just remind you that the most important thing is this station. The most important thank you that you will get is the future of this station, that it stays around for you. And let me just say, if you are a fan of the kind of deep, cerebral but accessible work that CS does here on Against the Grain, then this is really the moment to take a stand and let us know that you want to stand up for that work. I think the range of what CS covers on this program is really remarkable. It's really an honor and privilege to work alongside him. And if you feel like, as a listener, you particularly value his work and you want to show that, then please pledge at whatever amount you can. If it's only $25, that is absolutely fine. We'd love to just know that you're standing up and asking to be counted. If you can afford to give $1,000 so that we can, in one fell swoop, make this match, that would be wonderful as well. But let's all band together right now to try to make it happen. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA, or kpfa.org. We've got 7.5 minutes to go. We've got $1,000 on the line. Won't you come and help us in our time of need?
1-800-439-5732. Actually, Sasha, if you listen to every one of my programs really carefully, it all comes down to chocolate. Really, it is all just about chocolate, but we won't tell people that on the air. 1-800-439-5732. And your dollars are doubled. And this is a kind of a monumental match. This is the biggest match we've been given this drive, and it makes sense, right, on the last day. So your dollars are doubled at this critical time, and your dollars get you so much. Your dollars get you KPFA. Your dollars get you Against the Grain and Sasha's inimitable, ambitious programming. Your dollars gets you this compilation of 28 hours of one of the truly legendary KPFA broadcasters who also happened to be a scholar, a philosopher, an author, a lecturer, a widely respected figure among those who have brought Eastern philosophy and thought to the West. He was born in London, by the way, and then he came to the U.S. in 1939. He became famous as a leader of the Bay Area counterculture in the 60s, and a major figure and so much to learn from Alan Watts. 28 hours, that means, you know, you can sit down and you can listen to a little bit here, or listen there, and you can also listen again, because every time I listen to these talks, I get a little bit more. He explains things so clearly. He's a great storyteller. You are going to learn. You are going to learn, and you're going to learn some counterintuitive stuff, because we are so sort of conditioned to think in the West in certain ways. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. If you've got more than $180, we would love to get it from you. If you've got $180 to give, that would be great. If you have less, you can go on to kpfa.org and you can shop around for thank you gifts that are your thank you gifts for pledges of less than $180. You know, he talks about health. He talks about politics, does Alan Watts. He's got this hypnotic voice, and he says that we are wired to think in certain ways. You know, by the way, we talk all the time about getting in touch with ourselves. How do we do this? You know, how do we become self-aware? What does it mean to live in the present? Alan Watts sheds so much light on the current state of even the current state of society, one that he may not have predicted, but a state in which peace of mind and equanimity is so important to our sanity, So help yourself get sane, and help people around you, because you can share these CDs. We've got 4.5 minutes left. 1-800-439-5732. Get the Alan Watts Library Collection. Get your dollars doubled.
Yeah, and we urge you to do it right now, because we've got 4 minutes to go, and the steepest, most formidable challenge we have been given in this fund drive, We On Against the Grain. Please help us do what we need to do to keep this station on the air and to keep this program on the air. It's a wonderful time to let us know that you're out there and you appreciate this work, and to let us know that you're going to stand up for it in a material way and pledge what you can. And it is a wonderful time to pledge, because thanks to these generous listeners, these five other listeners, your dollars are actually doubled from now to the top of the hour. And as C.S. said, your donations are tax deductible to the fullest extent allowed by law. So when you pledge $180 for the Alan Watts collection, for example, we get $180, but you actually, at the end of the year, are giving less of your money, because you are able to take your donation to KPFA, most of it, off your taxes. 1-800-439-5732 is the number to call, kpfa.org. And I'd like to say right now that we are entirely grateful for whatever people can afford to give, and you only know that yourself. But if there is a time for us to get big donations, it is in these last days of the drive, and for Against the Grain, our last day of the drive today. So if you're able to give a little more or a lot more, if you're able to pledge at the $500 rate or $300 rate or $1,000 rate, I'd encourage you to think about doing it right now, and these listeners will match you. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732 or kpfa.org. See, as we have, by my count, less than two and a half minutes, so just a bit more than 2 minutes to go, and $1,000 is sort of dangling in the balance.
Yeah, and by my count, we have raised $711 in this matching period. So if two of you go to your phones and ask for the library collection, we will go over the top. So two of you have the power in you to essentially award KPFA another $1,000. So you wouldn't just be giving $180 or whatever. You'd be helping us make grand strides toward making yet an additional $1,000. 1-800-439-5732. Is it too late to call? No. No, it's not too late to call. And the wonderful thing about the Alan Watts Library Collection, you know, he clears up so many misconceptions about Buddhism. Buddhism is kind of difficult to grasp, and he clears up a lot of misconceptions, and he talks about how many of our problems are false problems. The problems that I grind on every day, how many of our problems are false problems and how we might be able to transcend them. We've got just over a minute left, and two of you have it in your power to take us over the top, to help KPFA earn another $1,000, and to help us as a station get closer to our $610,000 goal. How do we make money? How do we make that amount? We make it by small contributions from people who can give what they can, and in some cases, like right now, get a fabulous thank you gift. 45 seconds left, Sasha. I know we can do this.
I'm really hoping so. I really hope. I know there are listeners out there who really care about this institution. This is the time to come through. If you've been planning to donate at some time to KPFA, now is the time. As Alan Watts might have said, now is the time, because your dollars are doubled, and the time is running out for us, certainly here on Against the Grain. 1-800-439-5732.